Hello, and welcome to another episode of Muse on Minis, episode 337.
Musing and amusing.
This week, we have a light hosting arrangement with Nigel. I play Kador.
This is Keith, and I play Crix. We'll just say Crix.
This is Seabass, and I play Trolls.
So it's just three. We've had a long holiday break, and some of us aren't ready to come out of the holiday break yet, but that's okay. I mean, it's the ATC weekend.
Yep, we're still in the War Machine tundra, where there's no news and no happenings, and but we'll peek our heads out a little early.
Yep, there is the Black Anchor Heavy Industries drama with the hooch holler.
Oh, what's going on there?
It's $165.
So that kind of shoots down my theory that Black Anchor was created to keep costs down.
That's shooting. In real time, we're watching. Keith will be the internet. We'll play the internet in real time. That was like the first reactions. And then after that, it was like, the Seven Stages of Grief feels amazing.
The reactions have been overwhelmingly positive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big time.
I know for me, I unfortunately was a little vocal on Twitter about my frustrations over Black Anchor Heavy Industries and my frustrations over the cost of the hooch holler. So I want to take this opportunity to say I'm sorry, Will Pagani. He posted on Twitter like, "Hey, it's available for pre-order," and like I immediately replied, "Wait a minute! So you're telling me it's $170 and I can't buy it from a local store who I'm sure could use the markup on $170 item." Now, of course, there's plenty of logic and plenty of reasons. It's just my gut reaction. So I did publicly apologize, and I want to apologize again. My initial reaction was a little harsh, and I should not have reacted that way, especially in the public sphere. But $170 for a model is that's a little steep. It's a little steep.
Yeah, I'll say that I don't think, just in general, model volume, content, pieces, weight, size, you're getting what you paid for. Like, you know, they're calculating it based on, you know, labor and costs and other things. So it's not like it's an unfair price. It's just they probably should have engineered the model differently to not be that expensive. You know, it could be two-thirds the size and just be different. You know, there's probably some design choices they could have made to maybe make it a little more palatable. It's just weird because the regular...
Yeah, I can...
It's like $80 for the battle wagon.
Yeah, I can completely agree with that. I have no doubt, especially once you see like a picture of the hooch holler compared to like a Dracodile. The Dracodile is not a small model by any stretch of the imagination. And the hooch holler dwarfs it. Just in terms of bulk, in terms of mass. Like you can tell it's obviously a big model. The hooch holler is like 53 individual components. It's an extremely intense model kit. Like it is... It's extremely detailed, absolutely a gorgeous model. So I have no doubt that the cost that they're charging is probably very representative of their typical margin and their typical process to price an item once they go through the production and marketing and all those other things. It's just the shock to it, I think. The actual reaction to it is once you see that $165 price tag, it kind of takes your breath away a little bit when you see it, because you're just like, "Oh, we can pre-order. Oh, my Lord." And that's, yeah, exactly. That's literally what I did. I was like, "Yes, I can pre-order the hooch. Ho, 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 ha."
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I'm not, you know, like I said, I don't have any animus about it one way or the other, but I'm curious to see the effects of it long-term. Is this going to be a piece in which... troll players, and I don't know if it's good enough that it demands to be in every list or even a list or whatever, but will this be a sort of separation of the haves and have-nots piece? So it'll be interesting to see how many there are in circulation at the end of the day, like this time next year, how many troll players have one in their list pair, and how much the price will matter.
I really doubt that this level of pricing, like a 50% markup on one model, is the break point on the haves and have nots in this game. Like the break point and haves and have nots in this game is who gets to, like, who can afford to fly all over the world and who can't, right?
Or that are like, you know, some tier lists.
Because, like, when you're getting into this game, you're basically in for a grand to start, if you're serious about it.
Yes, but from a collector standpoint, the Northkin starter army is $185. So for $20 more, you get the Northkin starter army, which actually is sort of a misnomer because you get at least 10% off almost everywhere, if not 20%. So because of the distribution of it and your access to discounts, the Northkin starter box in a lot of ways is cheaper or the same cost. Additionally, there's some players who are going to be like, I could buy a whole other Northkin starter box. I mean, and just throw away the stuff I don't need. Like, oh no, I have 2 units of the Creel Stone. I'll just throw it away. Versus buying the Hooch Holler. It's like a huge pill.
I think for me, all the price on the Hooch Holler really is done is just make sure that unless I need it immediately for a list, it's just going to be one of the last troll models I buy. Now, of course, obviously, like you said, if a list comes out that just has to have it, like, okay,
that's the other.
I'll
thing.
Pay for it. But
it's the ratio of it is it's only legal in the Northkin Storm of the North, right? As far as tiers,
correct.
So you have it's $165. That's only legal in one list. You can play out of tier, but I don't know. It's interesting. It's like, if it was a little bit more ubiquitous to the faction, I could see, like the Creel Stone. If the Creel Stone costed $200, it would have to be an amazing model, obviously. But like, if it costs $200, every troll player could put their money down and not be terribly mad about it because it's going to be literally in every list and it's legal in every tier, and they don't have to worry about how they, you know. But this guy, this is like kind of out there. It's an interesting sort of weird choice. It's almost like a cosmetic. It's almost like a cosmetic purchase in an online game, you know?
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. I kind of expect to see a lot of converted Hooch Haulers, I guess.
I do expect to see that. That's the other thing. It's like it'll push their conversion policy.
And I wonder now going forward, because the Dracodile wasn't that expensive, was it?
No, not at all. It was $109.99.
So I wonder what the trend going forward will be, if this was a test balloon of some sort, if people are willing to pay for like the greater detail, the greater volume, if that's a market that's available to them. I wonder if this was a test of some sort. And I wonder what the price on Scar is going to be when she gets up for pre-release. Because if she's $150, I'll probably just like, the rules looked okay, but it wasn't like, this is changing the competitive face of Crix. I can probably give her a pass if she's $150. Mm-hmm. Plus shipping and handling.
Yeah, for me, the other thing I keep looking at with it is, like Nigel said, like you have to perceive value in the purchase, right? Like I have several other hobbies, and one of those hobbies is extremely expensive. It's a very expensive hobby. And I have closets full of gear for that hobby. And
Is it base jumping?
No. Okay. No, it's not. I'm afraid if you take someone my size and make them base jump, all you did was make a crater, sir.
Scuba diving?
Again, not sure I could dive that deep. I think I just would become buoyant.
Racing? Is it? Hi, Grandpa. Oh, I'm not talking to Grandpa. Okay, I give up.
I don't want to get into it, and it's a pretty controversial thing anyway. So,
the boom sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not rare for me to spend $500 or $600 or $800 on a Trijicon optic for all purposes I might use it for. But the thing is there's a lot of value in that, right? Because I can move that. I can take it with me. It's extremely rugged, extremely durable. It's tested all weather. So there's a lot of value in that purchase. So it justifies its price tag. And much to what Nigel was saying, I kind of look at that and I'm like, well, unless I really have to have it for this Northkin list, it's probably going to be a later purchase for me, because I just don't see – there's just not a lot of value that's immediately pushing me to buy it, because there's so much other stuff I can play in lists right now. But it'll probably will be a much later purchase. And I think a lot of like just kind of gauging the reactions of the Trollblood Facebook group, some of my Kith and Creel out there, I think a lot of them kind of feel that way, especially after kind of the sticker shock from the first couple of days kind of wore off and we all kind of came back to our collective senses and quit freaking out for a while. I think a lot of us are kind of in that same boat, much to what Nigel said.
Another thing that's going to be interesting how it plays out is if in a year, the aftermarket, so Privateer Press normally, right now the third-party market or the aftermarket on their stuff is pretty low. I've seen things go as low as 80% off on used models because right out of the gate, you get it at 20% off almost anywhere. And then after, if it's been around long enough, stores have overstocked it. A lot of them are like, if you wait long enough, even a store will sell it for 50% off. So that's caused the secondary market on the Facebook page to be all over the place. Like, it's just World of Warcraft auction house levels of, like, insanity on how low they can go. But this model is tough to get only from one source at full price. So if in 1 year all these you always have troll players either get buyer's remorse or they just quit the game entirely or they switch factions or for whatever reason they'll be getting rid of them. It'll be interesting to see what they sell for because I'm guessing they'll be able to sell it for like $140 or $160 and there'll be people be like, holy crap, I'm jumping on that, you know, like $5 off. So it'll be interesting to see. This will be the first model that like probably retains its value at a pretty high price point. But it just kind of, I'm just curious to see.
Yeah, and that's assuming there's going to be a sizable number of them that will actually even make it to the third party market. Like you said, obviously there always will be some, but I'm not sure how many of these are getting pre-ordered right now. And of course, there's absolutely no way to tell. I'm not sure how many of these are getting pre-ordered right now, though. So I'm not, you have to factor some kind of recidivism of those that will just not make it to that market. So it'll be really interesting. I mean, they'll definitely go, in my opinion, like they would definitely go for a lot more than the standard. Well, it's used 30% of retail or 40% of retail. Like they're obviously going to go for a lot more.
I don't know about that. You can hear me. I don't know about that because I've always found that with War Machine models, it's basically like a car. As soon as you take it out of the box, it loses 50% of its value basically instantaneously.
Yeah, I started at the same place you did, Keith. I was like, I'll just wait till next year and I'll get one half off. And then I thought about it. I'm like, next year, they're still going to be hard to get from only one source at a fixed cost. So like, one of the reasons in War Machine that happens is because the game is instantly 20% off and then is constantly being overstocked or whatever. People have bad inventories and then they have to sell half off and so on, so on. And so you just kind of have this expectation that you can get it at a pretty steep discount if you're just patient. But like Games Workshop controls a little bit better how their products get disseminated, and it's a little harder to find those deals. And then you as a seller can afford to be more patient. Eventually, as long as you're giving some kind of discount, you can demand a much higher percentage of retail.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Knight Models is actually a bizarre, completely opposite. Like, they completely turn the convention of model value in the secondary market on its head because they do Batman, and they used to do Marvel. Marvel's actually a good example. All their Marvels are out of print. The rules for them are still valid in their, like, superhero game, but they're out of print, and they purposely power creep them so that no one would want to play them. Like, they would all move over to the DC universe. And those models are selling for as much as 2 times retail. They, like, are super hot. And a lot of that has to do with, obviously, collectors who don't even play the game. They just want to be able to buy Spider-Man. But the Spider-Man models specifically are, like, 8 times retail. Like, they're, like, really expensive. I wanted to actually get Spider-Man dudes. I was trying to get the Green Goblin and his buddies. And I was just like, nope, I guess that's not something I'll ever have. Like, that was not going to happen. But
not willing to pay, like, $140 for a 30 mil Spider-Man?
Correct. Or, worse than that, is like a 30 mil Green Goblin. Like, he has these little goblin guys. They're basically just little robots with wings that sort of look like goblins or whatever. And I wanted to use them for Doom Divers for Blood Bowl. Like, this is not the model with which you're going to do a conversion.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there is some precedent for intentional scarcity to create value in some miniatures, because that has happened with a number of the older Kingdom Death models as well. Like, they have some of their big old centerpieces before there was even a game that sell for hundreds of dollars online.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Scott?
I was going to say while we're talking about the third party market, I did want to put out like Seabass's I don't know, PSA, if you will, in that there's been a lot of talk about going to recasts and going to recasters, and this conversation has been populous on the internet in a couple of different threads and a couple of different Facebook groups and then Twitter and such. I just want to put out there that stealing other people's work is not okay. As much as like I may not be a super huge fan of the price tag associated with the Hooch Hauler, you're not going to see me going out and buying a recast of it. Now, obviously, everything I say is not going to convince somebody who's already convinced that they're going to go buy a recast. I'm not going to convince people not to. I'm just asking, please don't like advertise this. Stealing people's work is never okay, and it is somebody else's work who's doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 100% fair. I think as long as you can commercially find something, it is inexcusable to go to what is basically a black market, buy the knockoff.
Yeah. The other thing that's problematic about it is that, honestly, you can buy so it's $165. For the $85, you can buy the Troll Battle Engine. And then for whatever, $35 or $40, you can buy the Bears. And then you make a cool conversion, which is balsa wood, and you can just make your own trebuchet that like launches beer barrels, you know, and you can actually go to a model railroad place and buy beer barrels to scale, and they're like $6 for six barrels or something. And you can kind of mount those everywhere, and then you've got, you know, like you can probably bits order Creel Warrior shields, the metal ones, you know. So you could probably make a very, very good battle wagon or your own Hooch Hauler that's just really good looking for like $40 off the price of the Hooch Hauler using all privateer press, like straight bits. But then you factor in that you can get those things, like the old battle engines are often on sale. You get them for, you know, 30 to 50% off, and then you have a really good conversion that's totally legal. Travis Marg will let you play it, and it's, you know, it's representing the same thing. You just have, you have two scatter gunners, basically put a tube going out the back of the scatter gun into like a beer barrel that's mounted on their back, acting as the two flamer guys. And anyways,
yeah, that's totally fine. That's totally fine.
Exactly. And that's what they've been saying, that like they've been everywhere up and down saying that that's all legal. You know, everybody's been like trying to figure out ways to get around the price, and they're like, that's fine. That's cool. And you're still supporting the company, and you're well within their conversion policy rules. So yeah, just do that. And honestly, you could probably make a cool conversion for a little more than the knockoff from China.
Well, even if you're like, I've seen a couple of posts online. I forget the name of the gentleman, but he posted this really awesome conversion he did for a Hooch Hauler based on a war wagon. And I think he said he's outside of the cost of the war wagon. I think he said he's probably got like 10 or 15 bucks in it. And it's really good looking too. Like, it looks awesome. And in some ways, kind of, there's some things I like about it more than I like about the original. But it's super cool. And because it's built on that PP model, it passes that 50% validation check. And so, I mean, obviously, like, if that thing showed up at an event I was running, I would have no problem saying, yeah, it's a Hooch Hauler. Anybody who walks by that table is going to look at that model and be like, oh, sweet Hooch Hauler, bruh. And then they're going to move on, right? Like, nobody's going to sit there and be like, well, that was 49.987% privateer press. Like, nobody's going to do that. Like, it's clearly a Hooch Hauler. So, and much to your point, like, I have seen, like even some PP staffers have jumped onto the Facebook groups and been like, dude, that looks really cool. Like, so there's been, like, some positive acknowledgement from privateer press about that. So I think that's really positive. So don't steal it.
Also, I kind of doubt that there will be enough demand to create a Chinese knockoff. Like, how does that? I don't know. I don't claim to be an expert in what drives the Chinese knockoff makers to make one.
That was some of the speculation. But you can currently get like all the battle engines from China and other.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
But yeah, one of the things that was speculated is that the market's not nearly the size as the GW market. GW is where it's really popular, is the forgery world.
Oh, forgery world. Yeah. That's clever as well.
Yeah. And at that same place, you can get some privateer press stuff. And again, I don't recommend it or whatever. It's pretty sketch.
Also, the quality you get is generally
it's pretty crapshoot. Like, if you know, hope you like modeling, yeah.
More work than a conversion to put the knockoff together.
Yep.
Anyway, that's probably enough of that.
Yep.
Agreed.
So I haven't really been innovating much lately because I'm still in that what's the Crix update going to look like mode. Like, what's the final decision on Satixis? What's happening with this? What's happening with that? So I haven't been too enthused about playing. I've been doing other things, but is there anything you guys want to chit-chat about? Also, I'm not revealing to reveal my secret tech ATC strategies with the lists I've been playing for a long time, mm-hmm. publicly.
I know for me, it's just been a lot of rinse, wash, repeat. I've been grinding Madrak 1, putting that list through its paces. You'll be happy to know, Keith, that your Madrak 1 list is propagated, I think, 4 times throughout the ATC. There's me and 3 other players playing it.
Can't say I'm super happy about that, honestly.
you shouldn't be. It's really, really good.
It's a little sketchy for me.
It's, no, I mean, the more I put that list on the table, the more, it's really hard to explain. And I'm sure to you guys, because you have so much experience, you've been playing this, just the number of years you've been playing is just so much longer than me, but have you ever, ran into one of those lists that it's just, every time you put it on the table, it's like you find a new hole to dig and then a new way to dig yourself out of it. Like, every time I put that list on the table, it's like I'm always learning something new. And it's such a straightforward list that's actually kind of surprising. But there's, I think, people who think that list is just one-dimensional or super straightforward. Like, I think they have another thing coming to them. There's a lot of layers in that list. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cool things you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I played the same kind of list for all of Mark II, right? Asphyxius 2, it looked really straightforward, but there was infinite tiny variations you could make that ended up making large differences.
Yeah, and I was in Mark II, kind of how I played Haley too. Obviously, she's super powerful and all that, but I was more impressed with how versatile. Like, a lot of people narrowed her game down to just something, but she had so many levels, it was ridiculous. No, I don't make that real observation though often nowadays. I think everything's kind of been boiled down to some pretty simple game plans, but I do put a list down, and I'm just like, after doing a lot of testing with Strakov and whatever and making all these cool things work, and you'll put a list down and then your eyebrows almost fly off your face because they're just, you're like, whoa, that game was a lot easier than I've been playing some Hard War Machine and that game was not Hard War Machine. And yeah. So I don't know if that's what you're sort of referring to with Madrak. If the game is a lot easier when the list is kind of doing a lot of the work for you. I don't know. But that's more my experience with
Wow, these 37-inch threat ranges with Zirkova 2 really make life a lot simpler.
It's not even the Zirkova I'm almost kind of off on now. I think she's very good. But she's also very one dimensional. She's powerful.
Oh, you were so excited about her.
I was. She does crap on Crix and I like that. But she doesn't crap on anything else and that's not that's a problem. That's probably a problem. But my other list, I was probably I'm just going to play this Legion of Steel now that Sophia whatever is out. And I'm just going to play Irusk 1 because I have literally not played Irusk 1 since the end of Mark 1, start of Mark 2. And I haven't really played him almost at all in Mark 2. Honestly, I don't think I've actually played him in Mark 2. So, I dusted him off. I've been playing the Iron Fang Pikeman list. Jesus crispies, that list is bonkers. And then also, I'll go into public service now. So we're doing all the token sets. We're getting everything updated with CIDs. So we're finally getting our token sets caught up, wood and color. And we were going through what do we have to do for Kador again? And I'm like, we already made the Old Witch set, which will be releasing soon. But I was worried that she had a token. So that's where we learned she has Righteous Vengeance. And I haven't been using that at all. I'm like, what? Yeah, Jesus Christ, she's ridiculous as it is. And then, she has Righteous Vengeance on top of it. It's pretty gross. But yeah, the list is when you play it, it's the game is so easy. And I don't know, you just jam 30 pikemen in people's faces. Maybe they're in shield wall, maybe they're not. You really don't even care because you can just feet. The Eros plan is to just run, pop a couple feet, go max distance, and then be 4+ tough immune to knockdown. And then they kill 8 guys and then you like slaughter the table. Like, oh my god, it's just so easy. But what makes it difficult, in addition to them all being 4 plus tough immune to knockdown, is all the counter charges that go through each other with tactical supremacy, or with tactician basically, and then they're all weapon masters with precision strike. So like, you can't really come in with heavies and reliably expect your arm, your favorite arm, or your cortex to be intact. And then, so then this like weapon master leap jumps through all your dudes, attacks them, chops off their arm, and then they're like, well, Jesus, good. So then they charge that weapon master with a heavy, and then that weapon master's two friends countercharge to save him. And then they're all at the end of the, and then they're all tough and immune to knockdown, 4+ tough. So even if you do get meaningful attacks, it's such an annoying hard list to deal with. Oh god, I've been loving it.
I played a lot of Irusk 2 in Legion of Steel, and that still to this day is probably my favorite list in War Machine and Hordes. Maybe not Hordes, definitely War Machine though. Just because of like, because Irusk 2 gives you another, like I think his command is 10. So he gives you a 10-inch bubble of tactician, and then you have Kovdik Markov. Yeah, for another 10. So you have like 20 inches of tactician floating around the table. So you have like all these countercharging dudes. You have Sophia, who can't die if they're killing other stuff. And like, it's ridiculous. It's a great list. And the thing I really love about, it doesn't matter if it's a Irusk or I've seen some Old Witch 2 builds that actually, because she has Curse of Shadows, they bring back Ulans. Yeah. Because if you ever get your Ulans trapped, you just Curse of Shadows so the Ulans can just charge straight out. So I've seen like some Old Witch 2 builds and stuff, and they all look super fun. And I'm really looking forward to getting Old Witch 2 put together. It's just so many hobby projects, and my beloved trolls require so much work.
Well, the other reason why I like Irusk is if you can hold your feet, his feet is +2 to hit. And this is totally unnecessary stacking. Like, it's absolutely not critical, but they're mat 7 base. Sophia is veteran leader, so they become mat 8. And then with that, they're mat 10. So just like, I just hit whatever. Like, oh, God, it's so fun. And then Irusk has battle plans. He hands out Pathfinder, Reveille, or Reveille is totally irrelevant. The entire list is immune to knockdown basically the entire game. But he also hands out Tactical Supremacy. He hands out Reform or whatever, the reposition. And a reposition's an interesting thing because you get advanced move, and then on turn 1 they can walk 6, reposition 3. So you get a unit that's in shield wall, 6, 12, 15 inches up the table, which is pretty nice. I mean, it's farther up the table in shield wall than the other two units could run.
Yeah, it's 15 up plus deployment, so it's either 22 or 24, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's
22 or 25, sorry.
Well, that's pretty cool. I don't know. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that's another one of those nasty scenario jams, right?
Yeah, I know. It was really gross. And then the four plus tough. I mean, I've played it a few times and had sort of okay. The 4+ tough's good. It always works. I haven't had a sub 500% or a sub 50% turn on it, but I did have at that tournament in KC where I made like 14 out of 18 tough check. Yeah, that broke the game. It was against Cray. It was against a Cray Jack heavy list, and that basically broke the game on its back. It was like, well, I was planning on winning the game. I was not planning on that. I was not planning on that. I was planning on this being a close grind amount. But yeah, that
means you weren't planning on the 5-0, the destroy 3/4 of his army shutout.
Yep.
Lose 2 models.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
And then, like, he would come in with an ironclad, and I would countercharge with, like, Sophia, and then I'd countercharge with, like, 1 Great Bear, and I would chop his cortex off. And so with his just base attacks, he would still force 2 tough checks, which I'd pass both or something. And so, like, I was actually shocked that with as much shenanigans as I was doing as he came in, like, knocking out his ability to make a lot of attacks, he generated 18 tough checks, which I was just a little bit impressed by. So it was actually that much more demoralizing. Like, I felt pretty bad just on that, because it was actually kind of an impressive turn from a, like, making things work around my shenanigans for him, and then not have it pay off, you know? Like, even if I made 50%, it's, like I said, I don't think it's a good situation, but...
Yeah, I would have some questions about that list's efficacy running into some more, like, effective ranged armies, mm-hmm. if it weren't so fast. I think its speed allows it even to play into some of the better gun lines with some chance of success.
Yeah, the other thing that, and I'm not sure how, I didn't play it this way. I haven't played it this way yet, but I'm under the impression that you can apparently mini feet with them, run, and then reposition. Like, there's nothing in the text apparently that says you can't.
Or, so the way that actually works, Nigel, is like you can declare the press forward order, mini feet before you declare the press forward order, right? Run, and then at the end of their activation, the press forward order is replaced by the shield wall order. Now, they don't get the reform because the reform is also an end of activation thing. So okay. You don't, for like whatever reason, you don't get to reform, but you can, as long as they're touching each other, run mini feet, run forward, and end your turn, ran, and in shield wall.
Okay, okay. That's what it is.
Yeah, there's no running and repositioning because of the trigger timings. Yeah. And just reposition says unless they ran or failed a charge, right?
Correct. Yep, but that's it. So, and that's actually really interesting with like Strakov 2, because Strakov 2 has Quicken.
Yeah.
So you can like advance move a unit of Iron Fangs and then dump Quicken on them. Like Strakov goes like super slingshotty forward, right? And then you dump Quicken on this unit of Iron Fangs. And then the unit of Iron Fangs mini feet run. And so your deployment is 7. You get the advanced move for 6. So you're at the 13-inch line. And then all of a sudden they're running 16 inches.
Yeah.
And then you're under Strakov's feet. So they're tough with +3 arms. So you have like a wall of like 10 shield-walled arm 22 or arm 21 or arm 22 Iron Fang pikemen that are defense 14, and they're all up in your grill and they're all tough on 5+.
Yeah, seems halfway reasonable.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, so I was like mining for gold. Zerkova obviously came to my mind, but and I was excited about her, but that was the fallback. Like, I want to have this exciting, sexy Corvette Zerkova 2 list, and then I'm going to have this boring, mean potatoes, old school garbage list that's just gonna like beat you with math and like, you know, be pretty boring about it. And then I was playing it, I was like, oh, I guess, see you later, Scrum 2. Like,
what battle group playing?
I think it's a Devastator and a Juggernaut.
Meat and potatoes.
Yeah, it's a bit, about as much as it gets.
I think the thing that makes that particular list so much fun is just all of the counterplay in it. Like, it's just, you always feel like you have something to do, and it just keeps the players interested and interactive. Like, it's why I love mechanics like Countercharge and spells like Battle Driven, and or not Battle Driven, but Battle Charge and stuff like that, because you always feel like there's something going on. Like, there's always something cool to happen.
Yeah, well, also, it solves the Nigel problem of sportsmanship, which is, I'm always like, don't remember, I've got Countercharge, and then they can, like, run Reinhold into melee with me, and then I don't have Countercharge anymore. So now it's like, don't forget, I've got Countercharge, and then they run Reinhold into melee with a bunch of pikemen who are in the wall in front, and then a Great Bear kills Reinhold, then they charge that guy, then a Great Bear kills that guy, like, and so on. So I'm like, oh, I'm getting my Countercharges. That's probably the best part, is I'm just like, splooge, I'm living the dream.
Nigel, living the dream is when you charge a character heavy with Markov, like you countercharge a character heavy with Markov, and you get the crit.
Down. Yeah, it's yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
100%. Oh, that's so amazing.
The sourpuss on Josh is just worth it. It was just like, I'm never not playing this list. As his mangler comes in, and he's like, I'm going to kill these Ulans with a Thresher. And I was like, oh, I'm going to countercharge with Markov. And he's like, what? That guy's going to countercharge? And I'm like, yeah. And then I'm like, okay, boost an attack on the charge. Oh, crit! And, like, the whole list, too, has, like, precision strike. The Iron Fang Kovniks, the little solos, they're part of their leadership bit, is they give you precision strike. So all the Iron Fang pikemen within 10 inches of them have precision strike. And
so Markov just comes in and crit knocks it down and blows its
vortex out.
Thresher arm off.
Or the Thresher arm, yeah. Like, GG!
Yeah. Yeah, he just drills it out.
And the cool thing is he's got two cracks at it, because you also have your
impact,
which is crits knocked down. So you have a unboosted and a boosted.
It's pretty good.
Yep, and Markov's mat 8 and 9 if he's happening to countercharge within 10 of Sophia.
I mean, boosted 9, you can miss that, right?
Yeah, it could happen.
Happens every day.
I try. I definitely give it a college effort most times.
What grants them all countercharge? Is that a theme force benefit?
Yep.
It's a pretty good theme force benefit.
Yeah, all the solos and the Great Bears get countercharge.
So that's Sophia, two Kovniks, Markov, and three Great Bears?
Yep.
All right.
Most average days.
I mean, it sounds good.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
It is.
I don't think it's, like, unbeatable or anything. I just think it's hilariously fun. It gives combined arm lists a tough time. It gives melee heavy lists a really tough time. And then range attack list, I haven't really played it into a range list, so we'll see. But it's fast. It's not like a slow jam. So
probably doesn't fare well against cricks. But
yeah, exactly. I don't think it's a cricks answer. Yep. Side note on the fun train though is it does bring back Inhospitable Ground, which affects only Menoth. Situationally,
I mean, nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. That's what I'm saying.
I know I always played Irusk 2 and Legion of Steel as an armor breaker. Like, I just, because, like, there's no way a list full of heavies trades evenly with that list.
Yeah.
Like, because they have to come into you. They come into you. You drill out an arm, you drill out a cortex, whatever. It doesn't matter. And then the turn after that, you're just like, oh, look at all these Iron Fang pikemen that are going to do two man CMAs under if I don't want to battle lust them, or if I do battle lust them, they're all just going to eat it alive. Yeah. And then, like, just. And I think Irusk 1 also has Battle Lust, right?
Yeah, for sure.
That's like his thing. So, yeah. No, that's really cool. I'm going to try that with Irusk 1. That sounds like a lot of fun. I love that list. Any time I get a chance to play that list, I'm going to take it. It'll just obviously have to be after the ATC.
I played two sets of pikemen and Ulans, actually.
Oh, you throw in the cavalry.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I think I like that. Both units regular?
Yep, both units regular.
Since the main advantage of the Black Dragons is the precision strike, which they get already.
Yep, exactly.
Although the armor mini feat is fine.
Yeah, the armor mini feat is essentially the same. It's almost the same feat, because the other thing is the Kovniks are giving them no sleeping on the job. So the Iron Zeal, no knockdowns not being really used. And then so if the regular pikemen just mini feat and run and shield wall, they're picking up plus one armor, right, in comparison to the Iron Zeal.
Yeah, they're
plus one up.
So they're cheaper. They have a plus one armor on their mini feet, and they basically got the same distance for their trouble, and they're still immune to knockdown with precision strike. So it's like, okay, I just don't see the Black Dragon point.
Immune to stationary.
I guess there's that. That's not nothing.
It's not nothing, but it's not much.
No, exactly. I'm not. I kind of like the idea of getting value if you can play around it. You know, like in Batman, Beanish. Made a point about there's a skill called unpredictable that allows you to, in Batman, you have to allocate every single model's like a warjack. You have to kind of allocate focus, and you allocate focus to like three different things. There's a skill called unpredictable, which allows you to re-manipulate those tokens as you see fit. But it's the models tend to be pretty crappy for you. You're paying for it. And so, you know, Beanish is like, I'd rather just be good at the game and get skills that are good. It's like his sort of. So I was like, oh, unpredictable, so broken. Like, you can just do this. And he was like, he kind of explained it that way. I'm like, oh. And in War Machine's kind of the same way. You like look for those little values. Like, you know, I don't really need, you know, this ability if I can just be good, you know, kind of like in Mark II. I don't need Gabe Reinholdt to check ranges if I just get good at actually knowing what ranges are or find other ways to triangulate.
Yeah, there are some abilities that I mean, there's kind of a gradient on which those abilities are scored. Because in some cases, like, I would agree with you on Reinholdt, that range guessing. It's just like, I can do this with my brain if I practice enough.
Yeah.
But for some other things, it can, those quality of life abilities can negate enemy counterplay. As an example, for that, I would list Tactician. Because that's actually something that comes up with, in some of the Haley 3 discussions, where people are like, I don't get why people love Hitch. And everyone is like, Tactician is the best rule that we all love the most. It's like, oh, just get good, scrub. It's like, no.
Yeah.
It's like, number one, no matter how good you get with Haley 3, time is still an issue, and Hitch saves a lot of it. B, the ability of when you're packed in that tightly, your opponent is going to be tempted to position in such a way that it makes them difficult to unpack against. And Tactician also removes that counterplay option from them. So it's actually, in addition to granting you more options, it is removing counterplay options from your opponent. And is Batman an I go, you go?
Yep, it is.
So I might argue that in Batman, something like Unpredictable also removes that that counterplay options from your opponent. I don't know the game well enough to be positive, but I think that get good might be a little premature on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, you're right. But it just was when I engaged it and thought about it, I'm like, oh, yeah. And then I've steered away from models with that advantage for models with more just meat and potato rules. But there's definitely get good. You know, the unpredictable is nice because you can use it defensively. So if you do miscalculate, you can reallocate your attack dice into defense to help, you know, block an attack or whatever. But it just is interesting in that thinking about with War Machine, like, that there are those models that, and Tactician's a really good one, because, like, you know, as a troll, you know, Madrak 1's got Tactician, right?
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And so troll players everywhere is like, hallelujah, you know, and they've been up until this point forced to be just get good. And it's amazing that as they've always had this, like, logjam of support, kind of in constant conflict of order of activation problems with their front line, to have this guy who solves it and everybody, of course, loves it. it was like, yeah. So yeah. Clearly value. There's a huge value in quality of life improvement.
I mean, that was the skill that I most admired Chad for in watching him play throughout Mark II, is that his unit placements were, sometimes it looked like an utter mess, but there would always be this corridor that he could sneak stuff through and be like, wow, you have practiced this a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
I know from a Madrak 1 player's perspective, double Fens champs, plus Creel Stone, plus support, would be almost unplayable for me if Tactician didn't exist. Like, if I really, really worked at it, like, I could get there. And to be completely transparent, like, a lot of times I use Tactician just to cover up me being sloppy. But the value to that is that you have so much more flexibility in how you get to unpack, because you don't have to think, two or three turns down the road in terms of, like, where is this one support piece going to go? You just kind of have to have, like, a general idea, and then you can kind of just move your way there as the game goes on. You don't have to, like, literally plan out to the proxy base a corridor to get him there.
Yeah,
no, right? Go ahead.
That list wouldn't function the way I envisioned it without Tactician, because the whole point of the double Fen Blades is to do that intermingling of vengeance units that makes them so hard to play against, and it's just simply not possible on a medium base unit like that without Tactician that you want to stack deep, and by deep I mean like 10 inches of board space front to back to preserve more of the guys in it rather than wide. Like if you have a unit that wants to go wide, you can get away without some of those abilities when you've got two units smushed together, but you can't do that with units that want to stack deep.
Yep, absolutely. And just the Chroniclers. Like, just getting the Chroniclers where they need to... I can't think of how much of a headache that would be, so I'm not going to. I'm just going to thank God I have Tactician.
Yep, I certainly miss how Dara used to operate, because he was not quite, but he was like a once-per-turn Tactician for Krix. In Mark II, I could just be like, ooh, I made a mistake here. Dara, fix it for me. Like, I didn't leave Tartarus a path to get out. Now he has one. Or I could potentially deceive opponents who weren't thinking about Dara's ability to create pockets where there might not be one. And they'd be like, all right, like, ooh, I made a little clump of guys here, but it's fine. Like, Tartarus is blocked in. And it's like, surprise, no, he isn't. Part the seas, and Tartarus charges through. And that's something I definitely really miss, because it frees up a lot of brain space for other stuff, right? You don't have to be like, am I putting literally everything in exactly the position I want it for every foreseeable circumstance? You're just like, no. It's like, if I need to make a hole, there'll be a hole. So yeah, Tactician, one of my favorite abilities. And I'm super excited that Axiara has it for Satixis. I think that's going to be very, very nice. Actually, sorry, all living Krix she has it for.
Nice. I mean, the sound of me muting was actually getting a little sick at my stomach, but good for you, Keith.
I feel like maybe Terminus needs that for Undead.
Yeah, I think Terminus needs quite a few things, but I have some hope that he'll maybe get some attention somewhere in the future. Because he's a caster that I've always kind of... I mean, he's one of those that I... How do I phrase this? I want to like him. Mm-hmm. It's like a couple steps removed from liking him.
Yeah.
I like the idea of liking him. But he's never been my cup of tea as it is now, and I don't see... Even when he was arguably powerful enough to play I didn't particularly care for him, but now I don't think he's even arguably powerful enough to play. But I think there's some value to his abilities, because you can think of Tough as, in terms of recursion, so it's like 33% recursion on attacks that are made every turn is not an insignificant amount, mm-hmm. Especially if you stacked like Necrosurgery on top of that. It becomes kind of hard to dig through him, but Mechanithralls are so blindingly easy to kill that, I don't know. I'm curious to see if Terminus becomes a thing at some point.
I hope he does. Terminus is he's a model with a bunch of rules that are really flavorful. And, he's really cool looking. Who doesn't think of, the huge winged demon, right? When you think of, all the bad guys and the undead and all that other stuff. So I hope he does see some love, because he's super cool.
Agree, disagree. He is conceptually cool looking. The execution of his model, I wouldn't mind a resculpt. But he's in that section of casters that, way back when, they were like, these casters will never be getting epics. And, we have no plans to, focus on them in the future. But I mean, things change all the time. Yeah, originally, they said they were never going to put cavalry in the games.
They also said they were never going to make Old Witch epic, and they went, oops. I mean, she's the first one of that group of four that they said they'd never do that with. So that's kind of cool.
No, Karchev was part of that group, because all those casters that came out in that book were large base.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
That was Apotheosis, right?
Yeah, it was Kray, Harbinger, Karchev, and Terminus.
Yeah, I thought Old Witch was in that list. As far as people that they said were like, we'll never do it because she's already epic. She's like Baba Yaga. They were like,
yeah, maybe. I mean, she might have been included, but she wasn't an Apotheosis caster.
Well, wasn't she? Yeah, she was. She was an Apotheosis. Mm-mm. Yeah, her art.
No, there was only four casters in that book, Nigel.
What?
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm wrong.
There's a ton, yeah. There's a lot of casters. Apotheosis is the caster book.
Because there was Epic Denegra came out at the same time. I thought Apotheosis was everybody gets an epic, everybody gets a large base.
Everybody got an epic, large base, and a another a wild card. And then they also got a Kodiak, or I think the Kodiak came out in that one. No.
Yeah, the Warjacks of Renown.
The Warjacks of Renown. Yeah.
So they got those wacky
things. Hold on. Let me appeal to authority here.
Hey, Marshall, what book did Old Witch come out in?
He says Legends, but he's double-checked.
Yeah, he's wrong. Legends is Eris 2. Yeah, it was Vlad 2.
Or rather, more importantly, who was the Kador caster in Apotheosis, other than Karchev?
Vlad 2 and Old Witch.
But there were only two.
There was three.
Oh, wow, there were four. Esorcha, Evlad, Old Witch, and Karchev. All right.
Yep.
I didn't believe you, but I was wrong.
All right.
Nigel administering the Kador and SmackDown.
I just remember I spent a lot of time with Apotheosis, and I probably would have eventually remembered Sorcha 2 in there, too. I just I can almost remember each page of art, because the art, I love that book, period. And so mostly I just would look at the pictures constantly of just flipping through the whole book.
Yeah, the artwork in that book was definitely good. The Haley 2 full page art is still my favorite piece of War Machine artwork.
Yep.
Regardless of how I feel about Matt Wilson, that piece of artwork is excellent.
Yeah, that was just an awesome book from a coffee table book standpoint.
It's one of the few pieces of artwork that depict a female lead character that aren't like, look how sexy she is. It's like, wow, she looks war-weary.
Yeah, she's not contorted in some weird,
She looks exhausted and still awesome.
Yeah, it's... Somehow I'm looking at a picture of a woman and I'm not seeing both her chest and her butt in the same picture.
Mm-hmm.
How do they do it? And then they use that prototypical female on movie poster to do the warp wolf, the extreme warp wolf.
Yeah.
And then everybody's just like, this looks stupid. But if it was Scarlett Johansson, they'd be like, that looks perfectly natural.
I have nothing to add to that, because that's shockingly and scarily true.
That's amazing. Oh, boy. I think to return to whence we came, Terminus is one of those models that it's like, when you put him together, you're looking at his dumb face and his weird arm, and you're like, ugh, you're so close to being awesome, Terminus, but just not quite. And I haven't even seen, I've seen some solid Terminus conversions, but I've never seen one that I've been like, bam, that's it. That's what Terminus is supposed to look like. So, I don't know. He would be up there, perhaps even my number one model I would request a resculpt for. at this point, especially if he also got some rules attention.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Keith.
Not at all.
Speaking of resculpts, Deathjack got his resculpt. It's on the PP store today.
Yeah, I saw the pre-work for it. It looked good. It looked fine.
Yeah, it's a good
resculpt. I've also had the same kind of relationship with Deathjack that I have with Terminus. It's like, that guy's been all right, but never like stand out amazing for me.
So like Deathjack's like hanging out like your window and he's like, I want you to want me. Right? he's doing like the full on like 80s teen movie holding up like the boombox over his head. Right. Cause he's like, love me, Keith. And you're just like, no.
The most use I always got out of him was in those 20-point mangled medals with Scar 2, where I'd be like, I'm Scar 2 Deathjack Nightmare and 2 arc nodes. Let's dance. And you would usually win those games, but I've never, like, on the full 50, now 75-point scale, a frontline Warjack with his defensive layout, like, 13-19 is, and this is going to sound greedy, and it is, but 13-19 is in a weird place where I kind of feel like both of his stats are just short of being good, and the combination on a heavy of his point cost doesn't result in good, because when people go to attack him, they work to mitigate one of those two factors, and if you can mitigate one of the two, the second one isn't good enough to hold him up.
It does make sense, because there's, it's like that interesting little, like, intermediary area where like it you would think, like, because people always talk about like the magical like 30 plus stat line, right? So if you add the defense value and the arm value, as long as you get above 30, that should be a solid stat line, right? And so you look at that and you're like, oh well, 13-19, like that's a 32 point stat line, that has to be good, right? Well, the reality to it is no, not really, because hitting defense 13 isn't that hard if you can get any, and I mean any kind of help.
Mm-hmm. I mean, oftentimes no help. Just a juggernaut comes up. He's mat 7, so you need 6s to hit.
Sure,
not unreliable. And then you're doing straight damage, assuming you're completely unbuffed, which isn't, you know, a term just can't be like, oh sweet, and which is a big. I guess that's a problem, because it's, you know, that's a baseline for a lot of offensive output. It happens to be exactly counter to his survival strategy.
So yeah, I mean, and just his point cost is excessive for. I think, and his kit is kind of dumbed down from what it used to be. So, I don't know. He's fine. He's good in the right situations, but in Lich 3, I wouldn't replace 2-point-something Slayers for him.
Well, I think that's
four Slayers.
I think that's a situation where, like, it's cool to have models that you just enjoy. Like, not every model has to be, like, crazy, like, on the bleeding edge competitive. Like, it's cool to have models you just enjoy. So with like Deathjack, like, yeah, I mean, I totally understand why you would not replace that. But if you're just like, if you're just a guy that's like, oh, this will be cool. Like, I'm going to play Deathjack with, you know, Mort Nebra 2 or whatever. And like, I just wanted to have this like fluff bunny game. Like, yeah, it's super sweet. And that, like, oh, that new sculpt, gorgeous, gorgeous. So I certainly couldn't blame anybody for doing it. But unfortunately, and it always kind of bothers me a little bit when it's like this, because like, you have like these really awesome jacks like Avatar, Deathjack. And it's like they just fall just a bit short. Beast 09, like, you have these jacks that just kind of fall just a bit short. And you just
want
them to be.
Not even particularly that they got worse in this edition. It's that their competition got better, a lot better. Or in most cases, just a lot cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, if that's one thing I hope they actually can touch on at some point in the future, is they go back and they look at some of the character jacks. Because, like, Ruin is super amazing, and Ruin is just amazing. But I would love to see like Beast 09 get some love, because Beast 09 a lot of times is just a better juggernaut, but not 21 points better. Like Deathjack and Avatar, like, I would love to see those go back and get like a little bit of touch up.
He'd just be on a lot better for 9 points more than a juggernaut.
Yeah.
And even his bondless Borsha helps, but it doesn't solve the problem.
I mean, him and Deathjack, yeah, Deathjack has. Yeah, I don't know. They're both sort of have huge problems. Also, I don't even think Ruin at 17 points is worth it, just an aside. Like, he's only good with Butcher, in my opinion. But and that's also Boundless Charge with the caster puts him over the top of, like, oh, sweet, usable. Whereas Beast 09's Shield Guard, I don't want my Warjack that's kind of a premium offense model taking extra hits. Like, oh, sweet, brilliant. Like, it's just actually just bad. And then Beast of Nine's clobbered in rules, but yeah, it's not worth it. Like, Murderous is cool, but I don't know.
And all those rules don't add up to much.
Exactly. I'd just rather take two Juggernauts and call it a day. And that's all characters.
That's one of my greatest hopes. And it's something that I've sort of seen a trend with in CID is little pokes at some of those character jacks, especially getting added to more theme forces. Like, just the ability to use them is nice. If in my perfect world, there would be every character jack would fit into a theme force as well as go with their caster, so that you always had the option to play with that warjack if you wanted to, outside of having to use its caster. Because there are just certain warjacks, like, I don't like Striker. I don't like any of his iterations, and I never have. And Old Rowdy is one of my favorite warjacks in the game. So Mark III is kind of a bummer for me in that respect.
Well, that would, from somebody who owns a ton of Circle, I would love to be able to put Loki into lists that aren't Tanis. If there's such a thing as a huge crime in my mind, like not being able to put Loki into a list. Getterix has one, but not Loki. Or like, oh, this blows my mind. Creel Company, the Troll Blood theme force Creel Company. It's all about the big guns, right? It's all about the bang bang and gunfire and all sorts of
smeg.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, sorry to blow up your ears on that one, but dear God, yes. Where's Dozer and Smig? Because I want a reason to play that model. Because that model is one of the coolest looking models that has ever been put. When that model was released, cherubs descended from the heavens to announce its arrival. It's so good looking.
Are you sure you're not?
Right? I want to put that on the table. Okay, whoa, hold on. Grim 2 did not descend from heaven. He created it. Let's get the story straight.
Yeah, I remember seeing Dozer and Smeg's model when Chad got it at the lock and load that he came out for, and I was like, that's a good-looking model. And he went together super easy. That was one of their first like in-house resins that they did, as I recall, and it was like, they should do more in-house resin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of their stuff has been... I'm sorry, Keith. I totally jumped in.
Carry on.
A lot of their in-house resins are really awesome. Like, you look at Rock. Like, that new Rock sculpt is so awesome. Rock, Dozer and Smig, Ruin is, he's a little static because he's a Kator Jack, and all Kator Jacks are like weapon, shield, stand straight. Like, all Kator Jacks have that basic look. But even for that, like, he has like a lot of characters. The new Behemoth is insane. Like, all those resins are so cool looking. Like, I want reasons to have them. Loki, amazing. New Getterix, amazing. I want reasons to have them in my lists.
Yep. And I just think that, I mean, it would be nice as a sweeping update, but I understand that things take testing and time. So I'll just hope for the trend to continue, that each CID, like another character jack, gets poked and shoved and given in, and put into a theme force like Charybdis. I've been thinking about putting him in a couple of different lists in Slaughterfleet now that he's available, especially because that list synergizes well with him, the gang fighter bonus and his 4-inch reach. Mm-hmm. And he got a fairly major point cost reduction, which is something he desperately needed. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the next CID should be starting any day now, pretty much. They said January for, I think, Legion?
Yeah, I think Legion any day. It's like either this week or next week.
It's like a Black Ogryn focused, or not Black Ogryn, but a Blighted Ogryn focused CID, I think.
Absolutely. And from what I understand, not 100% certain this is the case. I seem to remember reading this. I'm not 100% sure, but I think they're going to look at the Carnivian and Scythian chassis. I don't know for sure if I read that or if that was just rumor or not, but right. I certainly hope they do, because those are two heavy war beasts that are very expensive, and their stat lines on those chassis leave a little bit to be desired at their points range. I really hope they see some value.
Yeah, I mean, it was the gut reaction when they pulled Tenacity. We're like, what about all the heavies? And then they lost, like, a defense or something as well, and we're like, Or it was a speed, I guess, and we're just like, I don't know that that Legion chassis survives. And it took a while, but we were right. The gut reaction was correct for the most part. And so it'll be... And I think they're not alone in heavy chassis that need Elixir in hordes, like goats need Elixir probably, and some of the dire trolls still need Elixir probably. And
the dire trolls are
in a decent shape.
Yeah, the only one I really want to see get maybe a little bit of a touch up is the Blitzer. I think the Mauler is the default. This is what a beater heavy, beater budget heavy should look like.
But it's not really the Mauler, the Gladiator points.
I mean, he's it's not
Hordes budget. The question is the points differentiation between War Machine and Hordes, does it still make sense in a world with power up? And I'm not sure. Well, their ability to be good to the last drop is definitely worth some points. I just don't know that it's worth like the 33 to 50% markup that we currently see between the good to the last drop and Animus, right? Those are like their two factors that they have going for them.
Well, then front loaded output. So they can have, if you took four beasts, you can have all of them maxed out versus four jacks. You couldn't really max out four jacks typically.
Sure. But then they also have the inverse, benefit comes with a paired disadvantage, which is that war beasts are almost unspammable. Like, you can't do a 10 war beast list the same way you can do a 10 warjack list, because it will just be unrunnable.
Yeah.
So I don't really see that as a great advantage. And in a world where 10 heavy lists are super viable from War Machine, the fact that Hordes can't do that somewhat, to me, offsets somewhat or completely their advantage of front-loaded output.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting that in Mark II, battle groups, Hordes had big battle groups, and their beasts were just significantly better than Jacks. And it was almost like if I felt it would feel that way, that the troops were balanced. So, in addition, Hordes had less quality troops, which then only caused them to have bigger battle groups. And so it was like this sort of efficiency feedback loop that kind of informed list design. You know, there's like troops that just haven't been seen in like three plus years. And in Mark II, they made beasts way more expensive to the point where, yeah, you have like a three heavy type of a group type. I don't know. I just like, they're
beasts
so...
Beasts didn't get more expensive in Mark III. They just got that slight reduction in total list points made it feel that way.
Well, that and that, like, they didn't get reduced the way Jax did. So sort of like, they just sort of stayed.
Not to the same degree. Yeah. Not to the same.
So it just was like, yeah. And then their troops didn't come up, though. Like, so their battle groups stayed the same or got smaller, but the troops aren't effectively better. I guess when I'm complaining about this, I'm thinking Circle specifically. I think Legion has playable troops. Obviously, Trolls has playable troops, and Scorn has playable troops. But yeah, I always think of Hordes as Circle for some reason when I'm looking at, like, the quintessential like issue versus War Machine.
Well, I think that's probably because Circle at some level exemplifies that, right? They're almost the epitome of it. Because Circle, I think Circle's kind of in a, before a lot of these CID cycles started releasing and they got newer themes, Circle's definitely been in kind of a catch 22 for a little bit. Now that we're obviously the wolves have gotten significant upgrades since the beginning of Mark III. Like, some of those wolves have changed like three times now, just consistently getting better and better and better.
And cheaper.
And cheaper. Yes, that's such an important point to make. You're absolutely right. And so, like, and then on top of that, too, we've seen some of the Warcasters come back. So, like, Bradagus has gotten a significant upgrade. So, like, it's kind of interesting because I think, like, in a lot of ways, Circle epitomizes that. Because when you look at the changes, like, Circles are really relying heavily on Bones of Orboros as their primary workhorse theme. And then when you look at the Tharn theme, or you look at the Wolves of Orboros theme, you look at the infantry inside of those, and I really kind of struggle to find the places where I want to play those or to get those models on the table, because they just seems like they're always just missing something. And in a lot of ways, Trolls before that CID cycle felt a lot of the same way. So, I mean, I think it's easy to get into that. I think it's easy to see it that way, because I think Circle really does epitomize that on a lot of levels.
Yep, for sure. I mean, they're the faction with the most heavy war beasts as well. So it's easy to point to them and be like, look at how many of these are difficult to get good value out of. That's my phrase that I say instead of unplayable trash, because that's not a helpful thing to say.
Well, we are seeing some lists that are kind of going back to the drawing board. I forget what larger event here relatively recently was won by a Circle player, and one of his lists was Kaya 3 with like 4 Satyrs in it.
Oh, yeah, that was like Gord, I think, right? Gord Wepler in Canada.
Yeah, I think so. And so, like, come to find out, like, a whole bunch of beasts that can charge for free with 3 initials and 3 fury and, you know, synergy, probably going to wreck some stuff, right? Una 2's been making a comeback, but those are kind of the outliers. Like, there's still that core of, like, Circle models that kind of have to be addressed, right?
Yeah, I mean, they'll have plenty to do in their next CID, but I'm not like, it's not like, oh, whoa, is Circle. They're completely unplayable. It's just that some of their models are more difficult to use well, and maybe more situational or not really have a viable situation at this point.
Oh, definitely for sure playable. Anybody who hasn't played against Bradagus lately, you need to play against Bradagus again. Enjoy that when you get there.
I've played against him a couple times, not super tuned up versions of him yet. And once was with Cray, and I actually sort of out-heavied him, which was kind of surprising. But I think there's a version of him that you don't get to do that against. But Cray is in a unique position where he kind of just does, he sort of does Bradagus better. Like, his being Pathfinder kind of negates their advantage on being able to just rift spam. And then his reposition 5 is sort of like Bradagus' feet all the time. So Bradagus has a little bit of trouble that way.
Sure. That makes sense. And your guys also are threatening just so much further without the feet.
Further before he feeds, but far enough. Yeah. They're faster. They're enough faster.
Yep. I know from just a heavy to heavy fight, I played against a couple of lists that were basically just a whole bunch of World Wardens crammed into a list. And then you had some points left over for some World Whites. For some anti-infantry and shield guards, and then you have your standard smattering of support pieces, black clads and stone shapers and such. And that list was surprisingly tough. Like, that was a surprisingly tough nut to crack. Doomshaper 3 is my boy. He carries through. He does it anyway. But those games were close. It was really good test games.
From observing and imagining and watching play from Bradagus' side of things, the hardest part about that list oftentimes is fury management again. Like, when you're like, yes, wolds are amazing, I'm going to stack my list full of war beasts. And you're like, even when they don't frenzy, or almost especially when they don't frenzy, you're like, what am I going to do with all this fury? It's kind of challenging.
Yeah, and you're stuck with it. Like, it's not like it's going anywhere. And I think there's been some talk, and there's been some kind of mental thought process around, like, well, do we really need 2 sets of stones? And there's a buddy of mine, he's a pretty good Circle player, Ryan. And, you know, when you ask him, he's like, you absolutely have to have 2 sets of stones, like, especially in Bradagus. Are you serious? Like, Serenity is one of the most important abilities in that list. Like, you can't drop them. He's got a good point.
My friend John, who plays Circle here, has been playing what you call them, sentry stones with the gobber chef, and just feeding sticks to the rockmen to make them happy and remove their fury. But again, you run into the situation of there's counterplay for that. You kill that one little gobber chef, and then all of a sudden fury management becomes a huge issue again.
I wonder, well, you have world whites, right? So if you wanted to dedicate like a world white to protect them, I suppose you could do that. The problem, yeah, I guess, though, is that you run into like, but that opens up like a whole can of like positioning problems and like getting your gobber chef and the mannequin and the wold whites to protect the gobber chef and play. Like, yeah, that sounds like that could open up almost as many problems as it could fix.
Another model I might be wrong about, but I don't like the wold white. I don't think it's very good.
I've seen him in play. I agree with you. I think there's a lot. I have a couple. And I want to put them, maybe after the ATC, I want to spend some time into Circle for a little bit. Don't worry, trolls, I'm not leaving you. I still love you guys. I'm not going anywhere. I just want to play something a little different, you know, maybe cool my jets with trolls for, you know, a week or two. And I want to get them on the table, but so far what I've seen, I haven't been impressed. Their animus is cool, and I love the let's set everything on fire. But the problem is that continuous effects without some kind of an attack behind it, a lot of times just doesn't. Continuous effects never seem to do the amount of work you're relying on them to do.
And I just don't see the role of the piece. I don't see value in its role. It's like this, it reminds me of a Krabbit. Like, it's a shield guard that works a couple of times and then it dies. And maybe it gets one turn of its offense, which its offense is okay. It's like a little better than a shredder, like a Mark II shredder, I guess. And then, but by comparison, I could have, for not many more points, a World Watcher, a model that sits in zones and never ever dies, and with synergy is actually serious. Like, it gets up to PS-17 with synergy and the strength buff, and has two fists and two fury, and is a bit more, you know, it's that seems to be quite a bit stronger to me.
Well, and on top of that, too, he has a good gun with a decent rat. They're rat five. He has a decent gun. He still has fertilizer on both of his weapons. So, like,
yeah, I just see way more value in the World Watcher than I do in the World White.
I do, too. In fact, I was talking to Ryan about that. We have a group chat. We bicker back and forth at each other all the time over. I was talking to him about that. I'm like, man, like, I think, like, and I was tinkering around with list builds, and I'm like, why don't I just play, like, the Bradagus list that everybody played in Mark II? Like, I don't think that's that bad. In fact, actually, I think it's probably okay. You have five good guns. Fury management, of course, is a problem, but you have five good guns. You have fertilizer on those guns. You have fertilizer on melee attacks. You have stone form with arm 21 dudes with 22 or 23 boxes. Like, you stick them in zones. They're not going to go anywhere. You can't slam them out. You can't push them out. And then on top of that, like, you have something you can build into synergy. And those little guys hitting at power strength 17, I mean, yeah, they're not going to one round a juggernaut, but they don't have to.
No.
Like, a couple of those guys are going to deal enough damage to cripple a juggernaut. And then, like, what's a juggernaut going to do? What's a crippled juggernaut going to do against an arm 21 dude sitting there? It's not going to do anything to him. Like, he's going to deal like 7 damage to him total, and then he's done. And then you're like, oh, sweet, I get to beat up on him again next turn. So yeah,
I'm not sure I would format off that old Bradagus list, because I do think that the World Wardens are good enough to include two or three of, possibly even four. But I would look at a fairly even balance between heavies and watchers, I think,
yeah,
as a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. The list design I was looking at was, at first, there's like the old school Bradagus list. There's like five World Watchers and stuff, right? And I was like, well, okay, like, we'll play with this. So I think right now where I'm currently at is like three World Wardens and one World Guardian, namely because I'm just playing what I have. I only have three World Wardens. And then like four of the little guys. And I want to test that and see where it goes. It's a little strapped for support, though, because that's a lot of points.
Yeah.
So I need to kind of play with it a little bit. So I may go down to like three of the little guys. But I think even three of them with like a white and then maybe some other stuff, I think it's still going to be okay. It's going to be good.
Sounds reasonable.
So are you pumped for the ATC, buddy?
Yeah, I'm excited. I think we'll have a good time. And probably be.
I'm really excited. I know, talk to some folks online. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing like so many people. Like, I'm looking forward to just catching back up with a lot of people and saying hi and hanging out with them a little bit. So win or lose, whatever may comes. But, I'm looking forward to getting back in and just hanging out with everybody again. So it's going to be a good time.
Yeah. I did definitely get that, like maybe we're behind the times feeling. Cause Jay sent me a message. He's like, hey, Keith, how's it going? I was like, you know, living and breathing. He's like, are you happy with your ATC lists? And I was like, why wouldn't I be? I was like, somebody's seeing something I'm not. But I was like, yeah, they're good Crix lists. I don't know. It's not rocket science, but
yeah.
When I'm looking around at the troll lists and I'm the only Doomshaper 3 player, I'm kind of scratching my head going, wait a minute, I think I missed something.
I mean, you just missed the cold grandma hype, right? I imagine there's a lot of cold grandma.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Madrak is number one. Cold grandma's number two in terms of the number taken.
No surprise there. It's like maybe I'm the only one that after Denny One's nerf is like, that was totally fair. And this caster is still bonkers. And especially since we're playing her unnerfed version, it's like, seems like a no-brainer to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't looked at the list. Is there still a bunch of Ghost Fleet?
Very little Ghost Fleet. There are a couple. But not that much. Well, I think,
honestly, the only reason I didn't play Ghost Fleet is because I never had gotten the models together for it entirely. And once I heard about the nerf, I stopped even trying. Like I stopped my lookout for cheap black banes and the other pieces I was missing. I was just like, whatever. And I stopped, and I didn't want to like go through the trouble of borrowing them. That's the only reason I'm not playing Ghost Fleet for this. I would have assumed other Crix players would be, because it's like, we've announced that Ghost Fleet is getting nerfed pretty badly. And then it's like, so you would assume that everyone would stop teching against it and practicing against it, and that Ghost Fleet would be actually a good meta pick right now, but I guess not.
I think the inverse is also true at some level too. Like, all the Crix players were worried the Ghost Fleet was going to get errated, and so they were concerned about it. So they were like, well, this may come out beforehand, so I guess I'm going to practice what I do know. And so I think, we see, like, I think there's a fair, like, there's actually a fair number of all of the, not all the themes, but the Black Industries, Scourge, and Dark Host. Like, there's a fair number of all of those. And there are some Ghost Fleet out there.
Black Industries isn't ready yet. Needs the errata for that sweet, sweet unyielding change. And then the Slayers are coming out. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I'm actually pretty excited.
You guys are excited for the Slayers to come out.
I mean, I'm excited. I think it'll be cool.
I hope so. Black Industries
versus... Go ahead.
I'm saying I hope that errata drops before LVO so I can take Slayers to LVO.
I hope that errata drops before LVO because I just want that errata to be out there. I just want it because I know what it's like as a troll player to be sitting there, like, sitting on the edge of your seat the entire time just waiting for this errata to come out. So I wanted to get out there. I also wanted to get out there so that way I can start getting a handle on where I need to build, because that's one of the reasons why I've kind of remained a little stagnant with list building and trying different stuff, is not only because I wanted obviously practice for the ATC, but I also wanted to kind of get a handle on like what I should be preparing for. And I just feel like that's so hard to do right now when Crix, which is a huge question in the game, is a question in and of itself right now because the errata is not out. So I've kind of been like just trying to tread water for a little bit.
It's a question within a question, within a mystery, within a riddle, within an enigma.
Yeah, essentially.
Well, that's probably a great place to bail out. It's been 2.5 hours.
I'm done.
We talked a bunch of War Machine.
Good for us. We did well.
Yeah. How do we? How do we close the podcast? How was the official? Like, I know we each say our names, but what's the
Thank you for turning in to episode I forget of Muse on Minis. This is
37.
Boom.
Go, Nigel.
Thanks once again for tuning in to episode 337 of Muse on Minis. I'm Nigel.
Keith.
See you, Beth.
Good night.
Was it 337 or 327?
30.
Okay.
337.
anything we want to talk about pre-ramble wise?
Sure. What have I been doing lately? Still playing a lot of Gwenty cards. That game was just Gwent, the card game. It's still loving it. Still think it's a lot better than Hearthstone, but that's me. Mm-hmm. What else have I done? I'm playing Baldur's Gate 2 for the first time.
Oh, holy crap.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's like really missing from the standard nerd repertoire for me. That's one of the things that I haven't done that's been, you know, like D&D in general is kind of a blind spot for me. Because I always played different RPGs and I was like, eh, D&D, blah.
Yeah.
But so I'm sort of backfilling some of that stuff.
Can I make a terrible confession?
Sure.
I have, outside of trying it once, I have never played role-playing games. I played one game of D&D. And I was a rogue, and I had this list, this massive cavalcade of abilities, to which I had no idea how to use any of them. And I ended up, like, looking around at my teammates, and my teammates were like, you're going to go stealth. And so I look at the guy running the game, and I'm like, I'm going to go stealth. And I look back over, and they're like, you're going to sneak around the back. And I'm like, I'm going to sneak around the back. Like, I had no idea what was going on. Like, I've never been, in fact, actually, it's kind of weird. Like, I've never been much of a gamer. Like, if Magic didn't come along, then I wouldn't be a gamer at all. Because Magic was, like, my introduction into gaming in general. And from there, I went to 40K. And then from there, I went to War Machine. And that's where I eventually ended up settling. But I wouldn't be much of a gamer.
Yeah, I don't know. RPGs are, I wouldn't say that they're, like, required to have a nerd card. It's a pretty common experience. But they're like different people get along with different groups. And if you just never found like some guys you really wanted to play them with, it probably wouldn't work out. Like, and a rogue is certainly not the right class for you. I can't imagine Taylor the rogue.
Yeah, that is kind of like a, yeah. I think Scott Taylor the
Barbarian. I was a stealthy sea bass.
Yeah. Scott Taylor the Paladin. Let's be honest with ourselves. That's where that would go. Guys, we need to follow all the laws. This is against the rules. Guys, this is against the rules. That's Scott. Yeah. Whoa. Looting that body? Guilty. That is amoral, sir.
Yep.
You and I are going to have words.
Whoa. You're going to give us 1,000 gold to slay this dragon, but your town is in need. Let's just agree to 100.
But yeah, I mean, you have to have, like, especially the first time, it needs to be a little bit more instructive. You can't just be like, throw in, let's play, because it's not for most groups, and I know there are some that play it differently. You don't play it like a hack and slash board game, or at least I never have. It's a story that you're telling together, and it really needs to be like, so you have to be invested in your character and invested in what's happening and have a dialogue between you and the game master. I guess that's and not all people play it that way. That's how I've enjoyed it. But there are definitely quite a few people that just play the prefabricated ones and play it as basically a hack and slash board game a la Descent or something.
Yeah, I don't get the Pathfinder dudes who play it like almost is basically a board game, but
I know when we played it, we had like little models and we had like a big map laid out. And so I'm like, everybody's moving stuff around and like everything has like a movement range. There's so many squares. And the whole time I'm playing it, I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like, wouldn't this just be better with like units and like a tape measure and some terrain? And then I kind of pause. I look at the DM and I'm like, okay, sir, I think I'm going to go play some Warhammer. Like, I'm just going to go play this other game because it seems to click.
Yeah, D&D is more about the what's happening between the fights. That the other thing that's cool about Dungeons & Dragons, or just I shouldn't say Dungeons & Dragons, role-playing, is that the fights are like a punctuation to interesting drama. So, like, a lot of times, because I've basically been kind of like a munchkin-y player before, but, like, I shouldn't say munchkin-y player, but I've definitely had a lot of characters that sort of enjoyed the, like, let's resolve this with dice, and then you're sort of excited for it. But a lot of that excitement is because you're having such a great setup to it. Like, it's, you know, you've had this character that you've been going back and forth with for a few hours now, you know, and then now you finally get to punch them in the face at the bar or whatever,
Oh, yeah, I've definitely played characters that have started many an unnecessary fight, but it was in character is the point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then it's super enjoyable.
My favorite character of all time was a wizard fighter in the Palladium universe, and when I rolled the character up, I got a hilariously low, the equivalent is charisma in D&D. It was their social score, right?
Yeah.
And it was like almost the minimum that any living creature can have. And I just interpreted that as she was tone deaf in every situation and a complete asshole.
Yeah.
So I would just like moo at minotaurs and any other offensive thing I could think of at any given time. And the priest in our party, whose whole focus was like dialogue and negotiation, and he was a public speaker, and like he was starting his own subset of his religion and growing and just like trying to convert people all the time. And then I'd step in and like try to take over talking for him and just cause trouble at every occasion. And yeah. It was great fun. Yeah, it's a difference between being like, I'm just going to fight him, and playing the character.
Yeah.
Like Turbo Dish.
Yeah. Yep.
Roll initiative!
We accept the mission. I mean, it's really funny for me, too, because I hear a lot of the discussion between players and stuff at the game store or whatever. And like, I don't really understand like what all the, like the technicalities or what all the mechanics in the game are. But I hear like some of the just ridiculous things that people end up doing, like just the situations they find themselves getting caught in. And so it sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. It's just, it's really hard for me to find like a group that I think I would want to sit down and like have the story with, you know, like it's, I don't know. It seems like finding a good RPG group would be extremely difficult.
Not really.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I don't know about like your area and you know how far you're willing to drive and who you have. But I mean, a lot of the components to a good role-playing group you already experience, which is when you have a bunch of friends over to watch anime or whatever. So you just need to then have one of them be... A GM is a weird cat because they're creative. They're not quite a writer, but they probably want to be a writer. And they want to tell stories and, you know... have that. It's almost like the cool thing about GMing is that you're telling a story and you're creating a story, but you get this instant page by page validation in real time. And I think like GMs who like GMing, that's kind of what they're addicted to, is like, I'm sort of being a writer. And a lot of times they actually are trying to convert like, you know, whatever the result of the role playing game is, they'll kind of keep like a diary of it. And then that's sort of their goal, is to almost do fiction. But, when you have a GM that's sort of motivated in that way, it's super great. Because they are like a bottomless well, and B, it's very rich and detailed, which kind of sells the story. It allows you to kind of really get in the mood. Role-playing to me, when it's done well, is like, there's like, you're in the basement, there's like mood lighting, you've got the Doritos, and then
Lord of the Rings soundtrack playing.
Lord of the Rings, exactly. Lord of the Rings soundtrack, and then or maybe Skyrim or you know something of that ilk. And then you almost feel, even though you're in a room, it's like if you've ever seen like the Neverending Story when the kid gets under the covers in the library and he's like reading the book. It's like five people in a room together all feel like they're doing that. Like they're sort of all sort of got the flashlight to their face as they're like enjoying the story. You know.
Yeah, which is why I've never understood the like the role players you see. Role playing in game shops, I don't usually get that because those are more of the board gaming crowd.
Yep.
And yeah, I just like also because it's a personal experience for me. Like it's performing, but it's improv when I play. Sometimes when I play, and that's not something that I would want to share with that many people.
Yeah, you don't want to
not expose publicly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a role playing group is a little bit of a circle of trust.
Yeah. But yeah, sure.
I would imagine too, like the more trust you build into that like circle, like the better it gets, right? So the more each person commits to it, like the better it would become, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Usually role playing groups start in you have the writer, the GM, who's very creative, and then you have like
the marshal, if you will.
The marshal, and then one or two players are sort of like they're there to perform. They are straight in character. They're almost method actors. They will pay the pizza guy in character, like when he's, you know, they like can't stop. They're just like way into it. And then honestly, it's intimidating. You're like, so then when it's your turn to talk, you feel like someone's just put a mic in your face and, you know, you're like, And then, but yes, as it wears on multiple sessions. And so a lot of times you'll almost do like a, you'll see role players who are into the story and they're not bad, but they'll, third person what they're doing. They'll be like, well, my character tells her in a, this voice, like that's kind of how they have to, they can't just jump right in. They have to be like, so you're almost, it's almost like a telephone game, a one man telephone game with himself. My character looks at Keith's character and tells him with a stern voice, dude, you better knock that off. And they'll still kind of, they'll still kind of role play it, but they had to like not role play it for 5 seconds setting it up, you know? And then, and then eventually that goes away as the trust builds and people sort of get more comfortable. Then by the end, you know, you're just kind of, you're just in character and you're just reacting and having, and you know, you're laughing all the time and it's good.
See, it's funny that you say that, because like the game that I played was exactly like that. Like I would constantly look at like the people around me and be like, what do I do? And they're just, you know, they're looking at me and they're just like shaking their head, like shaking their heads and they're shrugging because it's like they don't want to talk out of character.
Whatever you want is what you need to do.
Yeah, well, and eventually someone pointed that out and I'm like, so like, if I just wanted to go full on Jack Bauer on this guy, like that's okay to do.
I mean,
and so like, they're like, yeah, no, you can do whatever you want to. And then one of the other players grabs my sheet and he looks at my sheet and he's like, no, no, you're way too nice for that. You wouldn't torture people. And I'm like, well, but that's what I would do. Like, because I was making a joke, you know, and like, they were just like, no, this doesn't work. Like you have to be in character, but you have to be in character to the alignment of the, how that person feels about good and evil and all this other stuff. And I was like, no, I chose the wrong thing at character creation.
Yeah, you always got to choose one that gives you a little room to wiggle.
Yeah, I keep wanting to say that the, and I'm going to sound stupid when I say this, because I don't know exactly if this is it, but I keep wanting to say it was like lawful good, right? Like
lawful good. Yeah. That's the D&D paladin one.
So you were the rogue paladin.
Terrible. Who would give you a lawful good rogue? That's just cruel. Cause you won't steal. If you're lawful good, you will not steal. Why are you a rogue? And stabbing people in the back? I don't think you'd do that either. You challenge them to honorable combat.
So can you even have like a lawful rogue then at that point?
Yeah, and yeah, my rogue, a lot of, I mean, you can have all the skills. You could have been like, my interest as a child was being an acrobat and I pick locks for fun, but I would never pick a lock that I would, that I intended to open the door of. And like, it would be awkward to say the least. I mean, I guess you could pick locks if you were working with law enforcement, like if you were trying to break into a known criminal's house to apprehend them.
Yeah, rogues would also make great performers, so you could be a lawfully good just performer who happens to be an escape artist or some sort of, you know, circus performer, or yeah, a law enforcement agent.
See, my guy was like a roguey dude with a bow and arrow. Like I shot everything. It's like I would like hide and then I would shoot things when the action started. And that was about as far as I got into it, because I think part of it too is like, and this sounds so stupid, as someone who plays like miniature games and stuff, but I don't have a lot of imagination. I'm not a very imaginative person. So these people are talking about like I have heard the term beholder probably a million times, like standing around the game store, whatever. I've heard the term beholder a ton, never actually knew what it was. So I guess there's a model of a beholder, like in one of the various miniature sets for Dungeons and Dragons or whatever game it is. And so this, I saw a picture online. This guy posted a picture and he's like, what do you think of my beholder? And it's this blob with a bunch of eyes. And I'm just like, I could have never imagined. First off, that just looks silly. That doesn't inspire fear in my heart. That just,
it does mine.
Makes me.
Because we know the rules for them.
Also,
like that, I mean, but like,
it's sort of a Cthulhoid monster too, so it also doubles down for me.
Well, yeah, and so eventually people explained to me, over this group, they explained to me, they're like, well, each one of those eyes has like a super magical, like ultra death ray, or they have like some kind of crazy thing. And so it can like, the big eye like controls all the magic that goes to all the other eyes, that control all the magic that like blow stuff up and make everybody's lives typically very miserable. But I didn't understand that, so I just looked at the thing and I was like, that's a beholder. Like I have no idea. Like that's what I'm supposed to be scared of. And then, in that same conversation, one of them showed me a picture of, oh my gosh, what is it called? It's like T-Rex. It's like a T-Rex type monster. It's huge.
Yeah. I used to know what it's called,
but and I don't know anymore. Yeah, like he showed me a picture of that, and I'm just like, okay, I would be scared of that. Like, that's a huge, gigantic monster, like, stomping through the forest. Like, it's going to eat me. Like, that would inspire fear in me. Blobby boy over here with, you know, probably has to pay way too much money in deductibles to his optometrist. He doesn't scare me, right? Like, it was just funny. So, like, I don't have that imagination to be able to draw, like, all this knowledge and, like, frame it and put it together and then be like, oh, this is amazing. This is super awesome. I just can't do it. My brain just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
That actually, I mean, it's... like many other things, it's kind of a skill. So you can practice at it and get better.
Yep. Do you read fantasy or anything?
I typically don't. I read. Now I'm really going to show off my nerdy side. I read a lot of philosophy. When I read fiction, I read like sci-fi. I love sci-fi. I never really got into, like, swords and elves and bows and arrows and stuff like that, which is a complete mystery as to why I actually play War Machine.
Well, it turns out there's a role-playing game, like, for every setting. You could just play a Star Wars RPG, yeah, exactly. Or a Star Trek RPG, or... Yeah, there's there's every kind of role-playing. Cyberpunk, yep.
I know... Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that'd be a cool thing to do. Try and expand my horizons a little bit. I'll see if I can find, like, a sci-fi role-playing game.
Yeah.
And then I'll join it.
My all-time favorite MULO to play in is the horror genres, the Cthulhu. By far my favorite role-playing setting.
I've never done.
Especially like Gaslight. If you do like Gaslight or just like, 1920s or World War II-ish. Oh, yeah. It's really good.
I've done a lot of fantasy and a fair amount of future fantasy, but not really any sci-fi or horror. Because I played one short Star Trek or Star Wars campaign, but
no, I know that Fantasy Flight is working on re-releasing the Legend of the Five Rings role-playing game, and that is particularly interesting to me because I was such a huge fan of the fiction and a huge fan of the characters when the game was originally out in like 1994 or 1996 or whatever. So if I can get, that would be really cool. If I could get an RPG going of that or get in on an RPG of that, that would be really cool. Cause that's a setting that I really, really love. So that might be something I could try, or a sci-fi one. That's really cool though. I am intrigued, and it will be funny to come back here like a month from now and be like, okay, so we were walking down this hallway and then all my friends told me to stop and I was like no, so I kept walking and then got us all killed or some stupid story. Like, it'll be fun to convey those.
I should warn you that role-playing stories generally speaking are the worst.
In that event, I will just message them to you and then you can tell me stop messaging me.
Exactly, that's the safest way to
although I mean they're not often like super riveting, but for whatever reason, they're fun to tell. Like, they're fun to tell and kind of crappy to listen to, but it's a decent time to hang out with friends, just swapping war stories, basically.
Yeah, though, like the war story swapping is good because it's like it's not so much that you're telling them like all the events of what occurred that day. You're just sort of like things that happened in the game that were exceptionally bizarre, interesting. You know, like usually
role-playing. Yeah, recapping the most ridiculous things that.
So in a completely unrelated note to gaming, I don't know how much into music everybody is. I know Nigel is. So I was revisiting some albums and I found out that there is an alternate version or like a re-released album for I'm pulling it up right now. So I don't remember the subtitle, but there's essentially there's a re-released deluxe version of an album from Bullet for My Valentine. So, and I actually really like a lot of that music. Like, I love, like, emo and screamo, and I love a lot of that stuff. So, but I didn't know it, but they actually have, like, acoustic tracks for some of their songs. So I stumbled upon Tears Don't Fall acoustically, and that has been stuck on my head for a while. So I don't know if anybody else listens to a bunch of music, but if you do, or if you have a listener out there who's like, I love Bullet for My Valentine, then listen to the deluxe version, because apparently the version of the album I got, which the album is The Poison, the version of that album that I got wasn't the deluxe version. So I had no idea these acoustic tracks were out until I was just perusing Spotify. And I was like, whoa, what is this? Sweet.
It's all French to me.
Yep. And has anybody been watching Black Mirror this season?
No. I've heard some decent things.
I don't generally like Black Mirror. I think most of it misses me. This season was mostly hits. Even the ones that were misses kind of hit at parts. I was like, oh, God, this is finally, it's like classic, like, I don't know. I used to love, like, dystopian sort of sci-fi kind of with the plot twist, you know, sort of ratcheted up Twilight Zone episodes, you know, and the first three seasons. Well, I actually, honestly, I probably started watching midway through season one and then kind of caught a few episodes. People were like, you got to watch this episode in season two or whatever, and I just would watch them and then want to punch myself. But this season was, like, fantastic. It was like, oh, my God, finally, this is, like, the show I want.
So I've been kind of told that Black Mirror is kind of like The Outer Limits used to be, only it has, like, a very specific overarching theme. Like, not every episode follows the same plot line or the same characters or whatever, but and neither did Outer Limits, but it all focuses on, like, technology and how it influences our lives. Is that about it?
Yeah, yep.
And you're saying it's pretty solid.
This season particularly, like, the first episode was this guy was a software developer. He was, like, the CTO of some sort of game company, and he created this, like, you know, MMO universe. And he's the genius and creator of, like, this huge property and the soul and heart of the company. But the entire company sort of hates him because he's just a nerd. He's an introverted nerd who's sort of awkward. And everybody just kind of craps all over him. It's all these, like, slick Silicon Valley kind of douchebags who just are basically exploiting him. Like, the interns won't get him coffee because they just think he's a dildo or whatever. And, like, he's really, like, crapped on pretty hard at the office. And so what he does is he creates a personal version of his MMO just for his house with, like, a secure server. And he gets DNA swabs of, like, everybody at the office. Just, you know, he, like, steals their coffee cups or whatever, or, you know, hair or whatever he can get. And he can scan it in basically this, like, personal scanner, and it uses their DNA to recreate a version of them in his own personal version of his game, which is based on Star Trek from the 60s. And he's the captain, and he's just this total tyrant D-bag. It lets him, like, work out all of his, you know, issues, but he's, like, a psychopath. Like, the problem is that because the computer is so complex, and articulate, by scanning their DNA, it actually creates a sentient version of each person. So he's actually torturing essentially sentient creatures, and he doesn't really understand it. I don't think he's even aware of it. He knows that they don't want to be controlled or serve under him. But it actually reminds me of the old Twilight episode with the hitchhiker or the drifter who, like, had to pull in for the night at some guy's, you know, at a family's house, and then the kid at the house terrorizes the entire house. Like, it seems everything's normal at first. But then everybody's clearly afraid of this kid, and the kid has, like, complete control of the universe. Like, he can, like, make your face disappear, and, like, his sister lost her mouth, like, years ago because she talked too much. And, like, he has that same power. So they're sort of, you know, like, one girl gave him too much lip, so he turned her into, like, an actual sci-fi monster. And so she's basically this big, like, squid bug thing that, you know, is just randomly trapped on the ship, and then he uses her as, like, a prop when he was running, like, away missions. But they're all, like, horrified. Like, they all came into the simulation with their memories, but then they don't so they know that they exist in the real world too. They also know that they're a fabrication of the computer. They're super aware. So he basically gets this new girl at the office, and she's, like, attractive, and she seems really nice to him. And so he steals her DNA and puts her in the computer because he's like, I'm going to have a new number one. And she'll, like, actually like me because she's the only person at the office who's, like, liked him. But when she gets there, she meets all the crew first, and they're all like, just do whatever he says. They're, like, panicking and, like, telling her, like, trying to prep her for it. And she immediately rebels because she's just a normal person she doesn't understand what's happening. They're like, they have to, like, oh, God, she's going to have to, like, you know, learn the hard way, basically. And sure enough, he makes her face disappear, and she almost, you know, suffocates, but she actually won't suffocate because he controls, you know, she'll just feel like she is. She's basically just being waterboarded forever if he felt like it. It's super interesting. And so they, like, have to plot. They, like, plot to try to escape somehow, and it's a cool, it's like a really cool episode or interesting premise.
That sounds pretty neat.
Yeah,
I watched,
it definitely sounds. Oh, I'm sorry, Keith, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I watched the Red Letter Media, the first part of their 2017 catch up, where they're just talking about movies that they didn't make full episodes about, and I have kind of a short list of films that I want to see that came out this year that I haven't yet, including some more out of the way stuff. Apparently there's an action horror comedy-ish movie called Mayhem. I don't know if either of you heard about this, but it's like a white collar, fantasy fulfillment. So it's like a virus spreads through an office and everyone just goes like full blown Hunger Games inside the office, basically.
Okay. I think I have, who's in it?
No one I've really heard of, like, okay. Steven Yeun and Samara Weaving.
Yeah, the guy from The Walking Dead.
Oh, yeah, that is him.
Yeah, I've heard of it. He did some rounds for it. I haven't seen the movie, though. I was like, this looks schlocky, I don't know.
I mean, schlocky horror is the only kind I like at all, so.
Yeah.
I might be in for that. There was also an Anne Hathaway movie where she somehow comes in control of a giant kaiju monster that's attacking Japan.
Yeah, I hated that movie.
You saw it and hated it?
Yeah, but I thought it was like pretentious and stupid.
Oh, okay.
it was like, white people are so important that when they have bad days, it manifests in Tokyo and they destroy things. Or sorry, Korea. It's just like, I hated it. I hated it, the whole premise.
Well, it got good enough reviews from those guys that I'm at least going to give it a go.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't dissuade you from seeing it. I watched it based on the recommendation of someone who really, you know, they like really liked it. And I was like, okay. Like, I don't know.
What was the other? There was a couple other ones. The Planet of the Apes movies. I've never seen them at all, but apparently they turned out pretty decently and they're done now. So now that it's like complete, I can just go watch it and see if I like it as a whole. Mm-hmm. I mean, Andy Serkis is great at motion capture stuff, and that he's basically the star of the series, as I understand it. So,
yep.
And then there's like an Aubrey Plaza movie about somebody who starts stalking someone they're following on Instagram. And that sounds bizarre and weird enough that I might enjoy that too. Ingrid Goes West, I think it's called.
Oh.
I have plans to watch many movies in the upcoming weeks.
Is Geostorm one of those?
Geostorm is one I've never heard of.
Oh, I'd put that on your docket.
Why?
Because it's awesome.
I'm getting red belted.
Well, you are. It's so worth it. It's so worth it. Oh my gosh.
The real question, Keith, is are you going to watch Sharknado 5 when it comes out?
No. The Geostorm, there's, once you've seen Geostorm, there's no reason to go see Sharknado.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there's no reason for Sharknado anymore.
It's like it's Gerard Butler in Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh, it's unbelievably spectacular. I was just there. It's like a 2 hour just getting an ice cream headache. I was live tweeting it, or I wasn't like live tweeting. I was like live posting it on Facebook as I was watching it. I was like, Jesus Christ. Cause like I was, I started watching it and I was like, just kind of goofing around on Facebook while I was kind of going on in the background. I'm like, wait, did that just happen? And then I just kept like, it kept having those moments. And eventually I was just glued. I was just like, this is, oh my God. And like, one of the things that people who listen, if they like follow me on Facebook, whatever, I apologize for the repeat, but like Andy Garcia plays the president of the United States. He's a Democratic president. Ed Harris plays the head of the Secret Service. And in the movie, there's essentially, so global warming happens. The planet becomes like totally screwed up. And Gerard Butler creates this set network of satellites called Dutch Boy. That protects, it monitors and does things to affect weather. So it actually curbs the effect of global warming entirely so that we just keep our climate exactly the way it is. And then this works for like 6 years. But Ed Harris, for some reason, hates the president or whatever he's, I don't know what his plot is, but it's the plot, I'm going straight to the plot twist at the end. He turns out that he's the bad guy. Ed Harris, in his big plan, Andy Garcia is having this huge speech at a giant stadium in Orlando. And he activates the geostorm, like the full geostorm. All the satellites go haywire, and it's causing like just absolute random weather everywhere, like crazy idiotic weather. And honestly, in the grand scheme of things, Ed Harris's plan works. Like he literally blows up like every major city on the planet. But they were just like, well, the president survived at least. That was like the silver lining. But like, Andy Garcia, Jesus Christ, is so stupid. So, like, firstly, Gerard Butler's brother lives on the ground. Gerard Butler lives in space. He's a space scientist. And he tells his brother that, like, we need the only person who can affect Dutch Boy is the president, and we need his password. And he's like, well, it's easy. I'll just go get his password. And he's like, well, it's not that easy. It's biometric. You need his fingerprints and his eyeballs and his DNA. And he's like, God damn it. I'm going to have to, like, kidnap the president. And he's like, it's the only way. And, like, so his brother, like, goes to the stadium, just, like, where the speech is being held. His girlfriend happens to also be a Secret Service agent for the president. And he, like, pulls her, as the president's talking, he, like, pulls her out. Hey, this isn't a regular, and you can always pull the attention of a Secret Service agent away from their job right when the president's, like, in full sniper view. But that's okay. Let's come on down. And she comes down. She's like, what? What the fuck? I'm working. And he's like, look, Dutch Boy's going nuts. We're going to have to kidnap the president. And she's like, what? And he's, like, on stage giving a speech, like, right now. It's the only way. She's like, all right, you go get the car. I'll go get us a president. He's, like, on stage talking. Like, what the hell? Anyways, so he goes and gets a car, and he pulls around front. And she comes running out with the president. You're like, what the? Like, what happened? Anyways, it was just that easy. Like, he must have just got done talking, and then they went straight to the bathroom, and she, like, peeled him out. But anyway, so they're escaping in a self-driving taxi. They point out that it's a self-driving taxi because this would be relevant. And as they pull away, a bolt of lightning hits the stadium, and then the stadium explodes into matchsticks. Like, absolutely, like, Independence Day, White House scene. Straight matchsticks. That, like, apparently the lightning was so powerful because it's a geostorm. Boom. Like, that's how... I don't know if there's a precedence for that. But they barely escape, like, imminent super death. And then the lightning is just coming down everywhere. And so they drive under an overpass. They, like... There's a giant, like, spaghetti junction of highway. And they keep the car under... So they're in a high-speed getaway being chased by lightning. And they're using the overpass system to follow under it so the lightning can't get them. And Ed Harris, who's apparently just outside of, like, the lightning range, is parked his car with his buddy, and in the back seat they have a rocket launcher. So they pull it out, and his buddy, and then they're just waiting for the cab. And so the cab escapes, they shoot it with the rocket launcher, and it explodes. And then Ed Harris is like, all right, sweet, you know, you just hang out here. And he goes over to the cab to investigate, like, to look for corpses, and there's no, it's empty. And he gets, like, out of nowhere, Andy Garcia, the president of the United States, punches him in the face. He, like, just comes from out of nowhere, punches him in the face, knocks him down. And Ed Harris is just stunned, like, what? How? How did you do that? And he's like, because I'm the fucking president, that's how. And I'm just like, I was like, Jesus Christ. Like, oh, my God, the dialogue.
How did Ed Harris... he was a good actor, right? Like, I seem to remember him being like,
he's a great actor. And Andy
Garcia, a great actor.
And Andy Garcia is a great actor. But in this particular instance, but yeah, that was sort of my
like, team. Looking at this cast list, it's like, this could be a fine movie. I mean, looking at the cover for it, you're like, this is a terrible movie. But looking at the cast list, you're like, this could be solid. There's at least three, four, five actors in this I really respect. Like, Ed Harris is one of my top faves. Andy Garcia is good. Richard Schiff I like a lot. Gerard Butler has his moments.
Yep. Yeah, this movie, it's literally watching Sharknado with, like, all the actors. Like, instead of Tara Reid, it's like somebody who's talented, and instead of, you know, Ian Ziering, it's Andy Garcia. You're like
delivering the same terrible lines,
the same lines. Jesus, it's unbelievable.
I'm gonna have to watch this, and I think when I watch it, I think I'm gonna have to get, like, a bunch of friends together, and then I think we just need to drink, like, a lot of beer and watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, they literally, like, tsunami, like, Japan gets wiped. Literally everything gets wiped except for the president. And it's like, it's cool.
He lived. Everyone, it's like the world is okay because the president of the United States lived.
Well, yeah, because, like, Ed Harris's plan was like, I'm trying to do political upheaval and then we'll have all new politicians. And, like, he largely succeeds based on my estimation, unless they, like, yeah, I don't know.
Hold on. Back it up. I had to deal with Aurora for a little bit, so I might have missed the plot synopsis. The plot is Ed Harris is trying to use weather-controlling satellites to kill every politician in the world?
Yeah.
I can't fault him for that plan.
No, it's true. Also, given that most of them are climate change deniers, it's sort of ironic.
Oh, man. Absolutely no hidden statement there.
This is one of those movies that's so brain dead, though. It's hard to determine what the actual politics are. It's sort of like, I don't know what's actually being said here. It's kind of actually exactly as dumb as Lethal Weapon 2, where the whole plot of Lethal Weapon 2 was that we need gun control, but you couldn't tell because they were too busy shooting the shit out of everybody. Like, yeah, get a Murtaugh. They're like, guns are bad. Get them out of kids' hands. They're like blowing the fuck out of everybody. Diplomatic immunity. That's actually Lethal
Weapon. Oh, I also need to see. I still need to see Gary Oldman playing Churchill.
Oh yeah, I kind of wanted to see that too.
Not because I love Churchill, but because Gary Oldman is the perfect chameleon.
Yep.
I wonder if. Yeah, I just need to see that. Gary Oldman is also one of my favorite actors. Although these days, it's hard to like actors because you find out something terrible about every single one of them the moment you say something nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Although it is reassuring that I pulled up Gary Oldman and I see under quotes he's known for, speaking very generally, I find that women are spiritually, emotionally, and often physically stronger than men. It's like, okay, all right, you're probably on even footing at the moment.
Again, the greater the heights, though.
Yeah. Keanu Reeves will never let me down.
It was funny because I read an Onion article talking about how Tom Hanks was accused of just being a good guy.
Yeah.
No one believed him.
Because I guess in reality, like, Tom Hanks was actually a very nice gentleman. He's very level-headed, very nice guy. From what I gather, I have no way of knowing that, but...
No, he's like a totally insane Scientologist who, like, held his wife in captivity for 5 years.
You're thinking of Tom Cruise.
Oh, sorry. Tom Hanks, yes.
Yeah, we're talking, like, Sleepless in Seattle, like, Tom Hanks. Like,
yeah, I'm on board now. When you said Onion article and accused of being a good guy, my brain went to Tom Cruise because that would be ironic. But
yeah,
for Tom Hanks, it's like he's only accused of being okay. It would be a great fall for him to only be a pretty okay guy.
Yeah, Tom Cruise has probably actually had to help disappear body.
Yeah.
Speaking of him. Did anybody see the Mummy movie? Has that came out yet? There was like a Mummy remake or something that actually seemed like it had like a cool premise.
It's out. It was okay. It's on. You probably can see it on Amazon now. It wasn't terrible. Actually, there was a lot about it I liked. Tom Cruise being the head of it or the star of it was sort of a dumb choice, to be honest. Not that he was bad. And I don't care about, you know, him being a Scientologist or anything. I mean, I do, but I don't think that never affects my opinion. He's just a weird choice for, because they're like establishing a franchise, like, so you have the Mummy, but you also have Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and Frankenstein, and other stuff in there. And they're definitely trying to set up like a larger sort of franchise arc with other stuff. And it was just sort of weird. Like, you'd think you would have got like a younger, like Chris Hemsworthy type guy to.
Yeah. When I saw the trailers for that movie, it struck me that they were trying to pass him off as much younger than he is.
Yeah.
Because the dude is in his late 50s.
Yep. And I don't mind that he's in an action thing. It's just, this seemed like a really, like, the beginning of a bigger franchise. It's like, how long is, what is he going to do this in his, like, mid-60s? Like,
yeah, like, they've got his hair dyed all black, and he's still got the young love interest going on, right?
Yep.
Still, the idea of having, like the old, like, Universal Studios monsters, like, all being put together in, like, this cool universe... Like, I'm totally on board with that. Like, I love Frankenstein. I love the Mummy. It's so cheesy, but I love, like, all those cheesy, campy, like, late 30s, early 40s, some of them even in the 20s. Like, I love all that stuff. Like, it's all super cool to me. So the idea of putting all those together in, like, one cinematic universe and having them kind of play off of each other, which is what it kind of sounds like this is starting to set up, seems really cool. So I probably owe it to myself to watch it.
Well, many people noted... when watching this movie. If they're intending to put them together in a monster team up, they've started out probably a little excessively high on the power curve, because the mummy is apparently nearly omnipotent.
Yeah, no, she is.
So it's a tough bar to clear. She like dissolves cities and stuff. But, you know, carry on. We'll see how what they decide to do with Dr. Jekyll.
I have long wanted to see a very a true horror version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Like, I think that would be like really cool. And I'd love to, I'm curious to see where they go with it. Because if they take like a very mature approach to it, like the split psyche and you know, the demons within kind of a story arc and the ideology behind it, like that could be really cool. And I love horror movies. Like, I love horror movies. I love horror games. I love all that stupid stuff. I love all the stupid flat slasher flicks, because they, I mean, you have to love them for what they are. They're just stupid, mindless, dumb stuff, but I love them for what they are. And then I love like really intellectual, like really terrifying horror and stuff like that. So I'm super excited about this.
So like science, every genre, like a lot of people kind of like, oh, it's just the thing they sort of, and I this isn't your intent. I'm not trying to like lecture you or mansplain something to you or anything, but I'm just, horror kind of gets a bad rap as a intellectual pursuit. I disagree with it. It's like, science fiction is, what's great about it is you deal with, like, science fiction is often used as a tool with which to sort of disguise or allegorically deal with social justice sort of issues, or, you know, just social issues or governmental concerns, or, you know, how does mankind work with technology? Just, it's a, there's a value as a way to digest sort of big questions, and fantasy also does some of that. Fantasy is definitely another way that gets done. But horror specifically as a genre is helping you deal with actual horror, like alcoholism, abuse, your fear of authority. Like, all those things are rooted in horror, and even schlocky slasher flicks are like, they still at the root level help you sort of negotiate a larger question, larger struggles that everybody deals with. And I love that about horror, is that each of the genres that I love, because I love science fiction and fantasy, and then I love horror, and I was like trying to wrap my brain, like, what do I love about horror? Like, you know, I don't discuss it intellectually the same way with people, and generally they don't engage me that way either. It's always like, oh yeah, Freddy versus Jason, and he like slammed somebody against a tree trunk or whatever, and bleh. But you know, if you really sort of think about it, like, I don't know, it's a topic that's been a little bit on my head lately, because I've been like freaking out, catching up on like horror stuff, and trying to figure out like, what do I love about this? Why does it scratch like all the itches for me?
Well, I can say, for me, as somebody who's currently shooting for my master's in psychology, it's exactly like you said. Like, everybody has like these innate inside your head voices, these fears, these things, that these internal drives. We all have these, right? Like, there's none of us live without them. And so and there are some horror movies that are just silly horror. Like, they're just designed around jump scares, and it's fine. That kind of fear is fun too. Right. But there's also horror movies that chill me to my bone. Like, to this day, I watch The Exorcist, and it legitimately scares me, not because of jump scares or because of the special effects, because those have obviously all well been surpassed by today's technology. But just that sense of losing yourself, losing what you are to something worse than what you are. Right. Like, that's a very internal pathopsychological or pathological mechanism that makes you fear that. And I love that. It's what I love about horror. So when you said that, I was like, oh yeah, I totally get it. Because you and I obviously probably like the same types of horror movies. But I mean, there's probably some difference here and there, but we probably legitimately like a lot of the same types of horror movies, because they deal with the same types of psychological principles. Like, there was a movie that came out, oh my goodness, years and years and years ago, with Nicole Kidman. It was called The Others. and it took place during World War II, London. And
Ghost Babysitters?
Yeah, the Ghost Babysitters. And, like, I loved that movie, not because of its jump scares and stuff. It had a couple, but it was kind of inane. But I loved it for what it psychologically did to you. Because protecting our children, protecting kids, like, even if you don't have kids, like, even if you don't have children of your own, like, protecting a child is kind of it's like a built-in psychological mechanism that we all have in our head. So when you see that kind of develop around, like, these otherworldly ghost babysitters, if you will, like, that touches so many psychological fears on such a deep level. It kind of makes you just think, and it kind of just chills you to your bone. And that's the horror that I really love. So it wouldn't surprise me if you and I probably share a love for a lot of these movies together.
Mm-hmm. I really like all the genres that I like. I tend to like a wide variety of them, like, for different reasons. The only genre I don't like in horror is the torture porn garbage. I don't really, it's like, that's not helping me work through anything. It's not
lightning. You're not a Saw fan?
No, not at all.
So yeah, I was doing a little bit of research on the Universal Monster Movie universe, and a couple things stuck out at me. Scott, you're probably not gonna get your Dr. Jekyll movie the way you want it, because in this franchise, Russell Crowe is the Dr. Jekyll, which I think is fine casting. Like, Russell Crowe's got chops, obviously, although he's been kind of phoning it in for a while now.
I mean, he's basically just in character.
And then, but they're describing him as the Nick Fury of this universe. Like, he's the guy organizing the fight against the monsters, which is, I don't know how I feel about that. Probably not great.
Mm-hmm.
Other interesting casting that's been announced so far. I'm not excited about this. Johnny Depp is the Invisible Man. Not a big Johnny fan these days.
Yeah.
At least
he's invisible.
And this is more exciting. Javier Bardem is going to be Frankenstein's monster.
Perfect.
That I'll take. The other weird thing is I was looking at the Mummy cast, and Russell Crowe's in that as Dr. Jekyll. I'm not sure what role he plays, mm-hmm. but, like, he's the wizened old doctor, and Tom Cruise is, like, the action hero male lead love interest. Tom Cruise is 2 years older than Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Fun fact.
That doesn't land well.
Again, his friend in the movie is Jack Johnson, his, like, best friend. And Jack Johnson's, like, 20 years younger than him. You're like, what the hell is going on? And I'm, you know, being, you can be friends with anybody. You don't have to be the same age. But it's like, they're like, I don't know. I got the type of friends they were appeared, like, they would go to, like, nightclubs together. And, like, his girlfriend is Jack Johnson's age. And, like, yeah, he's just, I was like, no, Tom Cruise, you're 55. Like, you go to Denny's. You wake up early. Nobody relates to any of your bullshit stories.
When he was younger, politicians were all honest.
Yeah, he's an old man.
But yeah, exactly. Also in Jack Reacher. I love him in Jack Reacher. It's just, but they still have, like, you know, it's like, guys, Jack Reacher with Tom Cruise is basically Charles Bronson in Death Wish. Like, don't try to make it more than it is. Like, there's the scene where he's like, I only wear one t-shirt and I've got to wash it because I don't do laundry or whatever. And she's like, so he's like washing his t-shirt and he's shirtless with his jeans on. And she's like, she can't function. Could you just put your shirt on? Ugh, I'm a dribbling mess. Like, you know, it's like Tom Cruise is 55. No one sees a shirtless 55-year-old and can't control themselves. Like,
it's just like, yeah. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I am a big proponent, huge fan of the old man action hero. You just have to embrace it and not pretend that you're 30.
Yeah, like, yeah, totally.
Be Liam Neeson, not Tom Cruise. Yep.
I mean, that's kind of what made Red amazing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, Helen Mirren with a sniper rifle? Yes. Yep. That is sexy. She's not pretending to be 25. She's like, I'm 70 and I'm going to kill you with this sniper rifle. And you're like, yes, Helen Mirren, you do that.
And her love interest is Brian Cox. You're like, a perfectly acceptable pairing.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce Willis was terrible in that movie because he hasn't been good in anything since The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, Unbreakable, maybe.
I thought he was fine in the movie, but I thought, Morgan Freeman was so amazing. Like, so amazing. And, but my favorite was, why can I not think of his... John Malkovich. Oh, so good. Like, but all, you're right, though. Like, all of them just kind of embrace the fact that, well, I mean, like, the name of the movie, like, Retired Extremely Dangerous. Like, it just plays on that so well. Like, yeah, it was so good. That's what made it great. So on that note, do we want to talk about War Machine, or do we just keep talking about movies? Because I'm good with either.
I mean, I guess
War Machine's all right.
War Machine's all right. It has been a 1 hour free ramble.
I wasn't thinking there would be much of a main cast this time. We're easing back in.
Yeah, it's been a long holiday break, everybody.
I mean, we are still in the War Machine winter where really nothing has happened, so it's not super likely that any of us are like crazy excited about things. Mm-hmm. We had one thing happened while we were away. The Gator CID dropped in with no surprises whatsoever. So it's I'm not too married to like diving into War Machine at this point.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot going on right now. Obviously, the ATC is coming up.
Yep.
Which I'm excited for. That's going to be a great time.
Yeah.
I guess we could go ahead and actually
start the cast.
Take it away.
Give me a second, and I will be right back.
Sure, sure.
I'm going to go.
I think we'll just be
a little quieter.
Yeah, this will give me the silent break that I need anyway.
Yep. I'm going to go mute for like 3 minutes so I can move around a little bit before I sit back down.
Okay, I'm back. Hopefully that helped the noise problem.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
Oh, this guy go to the bathroom or out for a smoke?
Something like that.
I'm back.
Got myself a beer.
Have you all been hearing a lot of background noise from me? Am I still sounding okay?
You're fine.
Perfect. All right. Sounds like things are working good then.
Yep.
Ah, Guinness. It's what's for dinner.
Oh, just straight Guinness?
Yeah, why not?
I mean, it is what's for dinner. It's like... I'm drinking straight bread.
I don't have an apple.
God, Colin ate an apple today. I almost fell over.
What's wrong with him?
I know. That's why I was like, Colin, are you what? Are you okay?
I want some yogurt.
Oh.
Yep.
Can you tell Uncle Marshall you want some yogurt? You going to sit with Dada? Okay. Did you have fun at gymnastics today?
I want the bottle.
You want beer?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Huh? I want that bottle.
No.
No.
Ooh.
Okay, off you.
I want to sit with Dada.
Of course you do. You always pick the best times.
And in the cup?
That's a cup.
We get beer in the cup?
No.
And in the glass?
I'm not going to put proof of me giving you alcohol. Online.
I'm going to have a drink.
Okay, but don't tell anyone.
I want a little bit drink.
You want more? Oh, okay. This will put you right to sleep.
Little bit drink.
That's enough Guinness for one day, child. Go pester your uncle. What number is this even?
Oh my god, I don't even know.
I'm checking right now.
What?
This would be 337.
Any old time.
337?
This would be 337.
Okay.